love your work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative. Find your unique voice, find the right mindset to succeed, and be the first to capitalize on new opportunities to make a living making your art. I'm David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. And if you want the very best of Love Your Work and the gems I've discovered in my thousands of hours of research into history's greatest creators, all in a short weekly email, sign up for my Love Mondays newsletter at cadavy.net/Mondays. We all want the work we do to matter, but how do we really know whether the work that we do does matter? Rob Wiblin is the director of research at an organization called 80,000 Hours. 80,000 hours being the amount of hours you will spend working in a typical career. 80,000 hours is dedicated to finding out just how effective various careers are and who is suited for those careers. The foundation of 80,000 hours is a philosophy called effective altruism. The EA community, as it's called, asks tough questions about what are the most important issues facing humanity and how best to address those issues. EA tends to come up with counterintuitive conclusions that go against most people's first instincts, and you're going to hear some of those counterintuitive conclusions. You're also going to learn, why did Rob insist on having a much longer conversation than the typical one-hour conversation you hear here on Love Your Work? He has data to back up his suggestion. And why should you stop listening to your gut instincts about what actions have an impact? Following the research can increase your impact 1,000 times over. And why are the highest profile issues some of the last issues that you should be giving your attention to? Rob provides a framework for making the most of your money, time, and attention. This is a much longer conversation than usual. I'd like to thank Rob Wiblin and 80,000 Hours for offering to cover the extra production costs over our usual shorter conversations. We paid by the minute for editing, and they were happy to chip in to make this conversation more in-depth. You're going to find out why early on in the conversation. If you'd also like to help out in covering the production cost of the show, support Love Your Work on Patreon. You're going to get early access to episodes and much more. Thank you so much to our newest member, Paula Schmidt. I asked Paula why he chose to contribute, and he said, "I not only love my work, I love your work." So thank you so much, Paula, and thank you to all of our ongoing Patreon supporters. You may have noticed that we don't currently have detailed show notes anymore. Not to be a downer, but we had some of our generous supporters drop out. It's not a big deal. It happens all the time. Some people contribute for years, others a few months, others only contribute one time, and all that is great and very much appreciated. So currently we're back below the level of having all production expenses covered by our listeners. So it's kind of a tenuous position. You know, money is coming out of the Cadavy Inc. pocket to make the show happen. So if you want the show to keep going, we really do need a boost in support. So please join Paula and all the other supporters at patreon.com/Cadavy. That is patreon.com/Cadavy. Here is Rob Wiblin. So I'm connected with Rob Wiblin here, and I heard something that I had never heard from a podcast guest before we began. As you said, "Hold on a second, I need to go get some nicotine." And I got the feeling, since you're from this effective altruist community, that there was probably some really interesting reason behind why you needed to get nicotine, and it wasn't just, "Oh, I'm trying to quit smoking and I needed to get some Nicorette or something."
Hey, David. Yeah, you're going to make me, or maybe us, seem like real weirdos straight off the bat.
That's what we're going for.
Yeah. So I haven't smoked. I'm not using nicotine gum to quit smoking. And I definitely wouldn't recommend smoking. It seems like one of the worst possible things you can do for you. But I guess I think of nicotine as kind of like coffee, but it has a shorter half-life. So if you chew a bit of nicotine gum, it gives you like a bit of a buzz. You know, you got more energy, a bit more focus for an hour or two. And then it has a half-life of about 2 hours. So like after a couple of hours, it goes away. So it's a way of kind of stimulating yourself, like giving yourself a bit more energy without it interfering with your sleep later on. And so for interviews, you know, it could be a little bit tiring talking for an hour or two. But I want to be like, you know, bring my A game. So.
Okay. And so it, Does nicotine itself cause cancer? Or
yeah, I think that's...
I just haven't looked at the research on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a big misunderstanding. I mean, obviously smoking is terrible for you. And I think for that reason, people kind of conflate all of the terrible effects of smoking with nicotine. But I think we could stick up a link to a really long review of the pros and cons of nicotine. And it seems like it doesn't really have that many large health effects one way or the other. It's like, you know, with coffee, you can find like all of these like slight positive effects and slight negative effects, but I think it's kind of a wash. I don't really worry about the health impacts of it.
I remember seeing some sort of, maybe it was congressional testimony or something where somebody was saying they were from the cigarette industry and they were saying, it's the smoke. It's not the nicotine that causes the cancer. And I mean, it was on like the Daily Show or something. They were making fun of it. But a part of my brain was like, oh, that might actually be true. I wonder.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's right. The nicotine is very addictive, kind of like coffee, but maybe a little bit more so. So it's like, if you know, you're someone who drinks coffee every morning, then you really want to have your coffee. And if you're someone who chews nicotine gum all the time, then you're really going to want to chew nicotine. But I think, there's not really much, if any, evidence that nicotine does do any substantial health damage. It's the fumes from the burning cigarettes that does you the harm.
Yeah. I know I'm very careful with like caffeine. I've actually wasn't drinking any caffeine for a number of years. And now I'm like allowing myself like one green tea per week. And it's great, but I'm careful to reserve it for the times that I like really need it. Does it have that sort of habituation effect?
Oh yeah.
Nicotine.
So to be honest, I think if you just use the same amount of nicotine or the same amount of coffee every day, then I don't think any of these things do anything for you in the long term, because your body just completely adjusts. I mean, nicotine maybe, because it's like gives you this kind of short like a boost for like half an hour or an hour. I think maybe that can continue to work. And if you like use it sparingly. But yeah, as far as I know, it seems with almost all drugs, a lot of people I know have kind of had an interest in like, what things can you take that can improve your life? Like what drugs can make you more productive or have a better life? And I think the answer is really, you can't get much mileage out of any of this because the body just adjusts to almost everything.
Yeah. Sleep is probably the best.
Yeah.
Sleep and exercise and a healthy diet are probably the best, drugs there are for that. But then there's still things you can take everyone. I know I take L-theanine. Every once in a while for like, just very rarely. It's just an amino acid. It's pretty harmless as far as I can tell. And that synergizes really well with caffeine. It's a really good focus one.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Is that's one that you've heard?
Yeah, it's a green tea's meant to have that, right? I think people take that with coffee if they get the jitters from coffee. I guess, to be honest, caffeine I don't find has very much effect on me. So, yeah.
Well, supposedly they can get, they can help take the edge off of caffeine. I actually have never been a coffee drinker, which is ironic given that I live in Colombia.
Yeah. Well, they're not big coffee drinkers there, right? I mean, yeah, you're lucky enough to be in Medellin. I was on a holiday there 6 months ago. I was surprised by...
That's a good point.
I was surprised by how little interest the Colombians had in coffee, given how famous they are for it.
Right. And I mean, because I think the majority of the really high quality coffee gets exported.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Was similar sort of thing. I know I have a friend who reports on cacao production in, I can't remember what country it was in Africa. Maybe it was Ethiopia. And she was saying like, the people who are working, collecting this cacao don't even know what chocolate is.
God.
Right.
It's depressing. That's... I mean, I studied economics, so this kind of makes sense. It's like, why would they be having gourmet chocolate? That would be odd in a way, but at the same time, it's a bit shocking to behold. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I think we'll get into a lot of the reasons why we have different assumptions about the way that the world is in other places, and that shapes the way that our behavior works where we are. In the present time. So anyway, the reason why you wanted nicotine, and we'll get into all this other stuff, was another thing that I've never heard from a podcast guest before, was that I made my pitch to have you on. I said, it'll take you an hour or so. And you said, well, can we make it longer? can we talk for at least 2 hours? And then you attach this paper to the email. And can you describe to our listeners like why you were interested in having a longer conversation?
Yeah, calling it a paper is generous. It's a little Google Doc that I wrote. So I have my own interview show, the 80,000 Hours podcast, where we do really long form interviews with people who we think are doing very impressive work about how they ended up doing what they're doing, you know, how exactly they make decisions about what they prioritize, and how other people can potentially contribute to solving the same problem that they're working on. These interviews, I guess, have ranged between like 1 hour and 4 hours. And we had about 50 episodes. So I fortunately, I think, over the last 2 years, Apple has started allowing us to get, Texas data on what fraction of the episodes people are actually listening to. So I can kind of see, the average person listened to 40% of this episode, or the average person listened to 60% of this episode, once they started it. And you can kind of see, more entertaining, lighter-hearted episodes, people tend to finish more of them. It's kind of as you might expect, or like things that have general interest rather than specific interest. But I thought, I should see like if I go longer, do people stop listening at some point? Do they get sick of it? Because I have a kind of advisory group of 30 or 40 subscribers who I poll for advice on like who I should interview and how I did in the last episode and what they want. And they basically said, just keep going. They said, go as long as you have anything interesting to say in the interview. So I'll check that. Is this group representative? And it turns out, longer episodes, people do tune out a little bit, but the effect is pretty subtle, such that I think if you wanted to maximize the listening time and you just kind of linearly extrapolated, then I'd want to do 8 hour long interviews or episodes. And I think it goes from something like, if you have a short interview, then people finish about 60% of it. And if I have a 4 hour long interview, then people finish a bit over 40%. So there's definitely drop off there, but, given kind of the fixed costs of starting an interview at all, it's like I got to find the person. I got
to wait. Let's get back to that math. You were saying they'll finish about 60%. Was that like a 1 hour interview? Yeah. Is that what you said? So that's 40 minutes. And so you were saying a 4 hour interview, they'll finish 40%.
Yeah, a bit
and
over
so
that.
So that would make that. I don't know how long would that be.
So they finish. Let's see, 1 hour and 40 minutes of a 4 hour interview, okay. Or a little bit over that. So, So certainly there's drop off. You can kind of see that, like each extra hour. So one interesting thing was if people stuck around for 2 hours, then they were almost always in for the full 4 hours. You can kind of see the gradual drop off on interviews. So it's like a lot of people drop off early on because they're like, oh, I'm not interested in this. I'm not finding this guest entertaining. But then if they've stuck around for 2 hours, then basically they seem willing to go as long as the interview is going to continue.
That's interesting. So, and you kind of looked at the data and saw that it wasn't necessarily because people see that it's 3 hours and therefore they didn't listen to it. And so therefore there's a self-selection bias. You didn't see a difference between number of people listening to an episode simply because it was 1 hour versus 4 hours.
Yeah. So that I haven't analyzed, and that is a potential weakness. It could be that people see the interviews really long and they just don't even start it. And so you get fewer starts. Mm-hmm. I should do that. I guess I was a little bit worried that the number of people who start listening to an episode is really affected by whether it's kind of an entertaining general interest episode or an episode that's going to go into great detail about one specific area. You know, for just the handful of people who really want to switch their career into that problem. So there's a lot of variation there, and I wonder whether they might get a little bit confounded. But
I also wonder if there's any pattern between who the type of guest is that you have for 1 hour versus somebody you have for 4 hours. I mean, I guess I could argue that you would have somebody for 4 hours if they were really important and a desirable guest, but also at the same time, those people are very busy,
right?
And maybe it's more difficult to get them for 4 hours. Is there any pattern there?
Yeah, I kind of scanned over it and I didn't think there was that big a difference. Because as you say, it's like, I mean, my initial request to everyone is kind of, can we set aside a 3 hour block to do the interview? But often, if someone's really famous, if they're a big name, then they typically don't have 3 hours spare because they've got a pretty packed schedule. So I'm not sure whether it's the case that the longer interviews were with people who are like more famous and more likely to attract a big audience. But I guess, you're asking good follow-up questions here. It's like, you've always got to be careful. It's like, you got numbers on some things, but not on other stuff. And social science is complicated.
Well, because this is something I'm really thinking about. And I mentioned I polled my Patreon supporters about what sort of things they would like to see if we had more funding. Would they like to see longer interviews is one of the things. And pretty much nobody wanted that. That's what they said anyway. Now, I don't know how much weight I should give that. I personally like to listen to long interviews. Mm. I do have worries about how well I can attract somebody like Seth Godin, who's big in our marketing world. You know, can I get him to agree to a 2-hour interview and things like that? So this was very interesting to me. I guess one of the things being that it sounded like the thing you were optimizing for is maximum number of minutes listened, regardless of how many people were listening.
Yeah, interesting. So it's absolutely not the case that just I'm maximizing the number of hours listened to without any constraints.
Okay.
Because then I'll just do a highly, you know, a really entertaining comedy podcast or something like that. It's kind of given that we're going to do like serious conversations about really important issues and how people can use their careers to solve them. Then maybe I'll want to, then I think for the same amount of work, I can get people to, you know, listen to a really high quality conversation for longer. Then that sounds pretty good to me. I guess we only kind of cover half of the argument here. So we talked about how people don't drop off that sharply as the interviews get longer. But as an economist, I kind of think about this in terms of like fixed and variable costs. So you've got this kind of, to interview anyone at all, you've got this fixed cost of kind of finding them, emailing them, setting up the time. You've got to like read a bunch of their stuff so you can ask sensible questions. And you've got to like make the connection, check the audio is good, so on and so on. It's kind of all these fixed costs. You're just going to talk with them for only like 15 minutes or half an hour. And then having gone 1 hour, the cost of recording just a second hour or even a third hour becomes, I think, really small because we're not doing that much detailed editing on the conversations. It's like we cut out, you know, answers that don't go anywhere, or, you know, mistakes that people make. But by and large, it's pretty straightforward, the later editing process. And then we're going to write a blog post for it. We're going to, you know, push it out and promote it. And that's all fixed costs. And so it just seems if we can get, you know, plus 50% listening time, just by like making the interview a bit longer. And then basically, yeah, all of these fixed costs of having the interview are the same. And I think the efficiency, I calculated that the like hours listened per hour of my work of the second hour was like much higher.
Okay. So it's almost like the profit margin
or the
time
incremental
invested versus, and then I thought, well, there could be sort of a repugnant conclusion version of this where it's like, you have billions of listeners, but they all listened for 1 second and got no value out of it. And then I was like, well, okay, maybe that isn't the thing that he's trying to optimize is total time listened.
No, I mean, so here's another thing. So when I'm interviewing people, very often I'm interviewing people who've done other interviews. And if I'm interviewing them for an hour, I kind of have to bring listeners up to speed on just the basic argument that this person is making or kind of the basic thing that they're doing or the case in their book or whatever. And so if I'm interviewing them for an hour, very often I have to ask them very similar questions to what other people have asked them on other interviews that are already public. It's in the second and third hour that you can push forward to like the frontier of questions that they've never had to address before, like really dive down into stuff that isn't on the public record. So not only do I think it's kind of cheaper in terms of like listening time per hour, but I think often the second and third hour are like more informative, more valuable.
But what if you skipped over the stuff about their back? I mean, is it possible to skip over the stuff about their background or summarize it in some way that can give the listeners an idea, but then go into the deeper stuff? Is that possible?
That is possible. So for example, recently I interviewed Professor Cass Sunstein, who wrote Nudge, who worked in the Obama administration, very busy guy. So I asked him for 3 hours and he was like, well, normally I only do half hour interviews, but okay, I'll give you an hour. I'll give it that you asked for three upfront. And we were talking about his book, How Change Happens, which is about how like social movements kind of arise fairly chaotically and surprisingly and often change society very quickly. And it's in unpredictable ways. Given that I only had him for an hour, my editor went and found a public lecture that he'd given about the book and then edited it down. So it was like very tight. And then we had a kind of a 40 minute lecture at the beginning where he explains what he's claiming in the book. And then we could jump right into kind of my follow-up questions about like, you know, weaknesses and implications of the book. So yeah, it is possible to do that.
And I believe I heard you mention somewhere that also if you do this longer interview, then sort of that, if it's somebody who's been interviewed a number of times, then that can kind of become the alpha interview of, I don't know if that's the right term, the best interview that represents that person that then gets linked to more or gets more attention.
Yeah, I think from a listener's point of view, it's really nice to have just like one 3-hour interview that's all cohesive where they don't repeat themselves and that kind of takes you from nothing to understanding kind of everything that you would like to know about that person's work or about their book and like their general perspective on the world. So that's kind of ideal if I can produce something like that. And then obviously, yeah, it becomes kind of the reference point for anyone who's curious about that public intellectual.
Okay, so this would be something I continue to think about. Just thanks for bearing with me as we get into the weeds on that, because it's something that I've thought about, and I would like to hear what my listeners think, because I have thought about, you know, maybe instead of 2 1-hour interviews a month, it's 1 2-hour interview a month, and I really get more time to talk to somebody, because it's really what I prefer to listen to, and more I'm learning that the things that I prefer it's better for me to make those things.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of this very measured conversation that we just had about what we're optimizing for when it comes to podcasts is relevant to this whole idea of effective altruism, which is, I guess, the foundation of effective altruism, or sorry, the foundation of 80,000 hours. So can you give us a little bit of an introduction to what effective altruism is?
Yeah, so the elevator pitch of effective altruism is that it's kind of the use of evidence and careful analysis to figure out how we can do the most good in the world. And then hopefully, you know, following through and using some of your time and money to actually go and do those things. And I guess trying to be a little bit more concrete, effective altruism and people involved in the effective altruism community kind of aim to help people and animals, or, you know, sentient beings in the biggest way possible. You can either do that by kind of helping more people or helping the same number of people in an even bigger way. And so it kind of focuses on improving welfare and improving welfare, you know, in a really big way. Although people have a range of views on, like, what is it to have a good life? What is it to have a high level of welfare? And I guess kind of some of the things that people involved in the EA community have worked on with the goal of trying to make the world a much better place in a really big way is kind of inventing really amazing meat substitutes so that we can get rid of factory farming and kind of the enormous suffering that almost certainly entails. Kind of going into public service, perhaps like the military or political careers, in order to try to lower the risk of a war between the US and China, which seems possible in the 21st century and would kind of be like one of the worst things that's ever happened in human history and would really take us off track, rather than kind of continuing forward into the better future that it seems like is possible today. Figuring out, doing research, science research to figure out whether we should use gene drives to just completely eliminate the mosquitoes that carry malaria and potentially just eradicate malaria from the earth using this like relatively new and interesting but possibly dangerous technology. And I guess also researching how to make advanced artificial intelligence, which it seems like could appear in the next few decades or the next century or two. How to make that kind of transformative AI safe and aligned with human goals when it's actually deployed in important roles in society so that it does what we intend rather than kind of going off the rails, which seems mm-hmm. like it could be a possibility if we deploy it prematurely.
And it sounds like you're talking about some things that most people probably don't think about. I guess when most people think about making a difference, they might want to adopt a dog or walk instead of drive their car, or put their soda cans in recycling, things like that. Yeah. And so, I mean, the things that you just talked about are such a huge departure from, I guess, the everyday or the everyday things that people think about when they think about being effective, I guess, is maybe effective isn't the word that they would use probably.
Yeah. So I guess I've kind of chosen those examples as being, they're kind of exciting, interesting, provocative examples of really impressive things that people can do, especially, you know, if they're just graduating, they have like a lot of potential in front of them and they're very ambitious about trying to change the world in a really huge way. There's other things that people can do that aren't quite as, you know, life-changing as going into the military to try to prevent a global power war, but we can potentially get into some of those. But I guess I do encourage people... We tend to focus, our audience is to a significant extent like really privileged people, like really smart people who've graduated from, you know, impressive universities. They have a lot of potential to improve the world. And often it seems like their lives by and large are going to be fine. They're not really, you know, too worried about their finances. They're not worried about, you know, ending up unemployed or unable to pay their bills. And I think for those people, having been so fortunate, being among the most fortunate people in the world, I think some people might think it's a duty, but at least I think it would be a very good thing for them to think about how they can give back, how they can, help others, not just in a small way, but in like a really big way, in a transformative way.
So it's like if you get to the point where most of your problems are first world problems, maybe it's time to pick some more difficult problems to solve. Like one way of looking at it is that it might be your duty to do so.
Yeah, I think if all your problems are just first world problems, and I don't want to say like everyone who's now wealthy in the developing world is, you know, super happy. Like people have mental health problems, they have like all kinds of personal issues. But if you think of yourself as like someone who has it really, really good, then I think you should think more ambitiously than just trying to recycle. there's things you can do that are like potentially a million times more valuable than just recycling. Maybe we can get into some of those and how you might be able to identify them.
And so you work for this organization 80,000 hours. And as I said, Effective Altruism is the foundation upon which 80,000 hours stands. Is that about right? Can you tell us about 80,000 hours?
Yeah. So Effective Altruism is this kind of broader social movement, broader community that's focused on trying to do as much good as possible. And 80,000 hours is kind of one of the organizations that started around the same time as the term Effective Altruism was taking off. And we've kind of bitten off this one part of the problem, which is trying to figure out how you can do the most good with your career specifically, especially if you're kind of a graduate aged, you know, 25 to 40 who wants to focus really ambitiously on social impact. Although, you know, a lot of our advice is relevant to other people. So these days, we're a nonprofit and we're kind of focused on trying to solve the most pressing skill bottlenecks in the world's most pressing problems. And we kind of do this. We have the podcast, as we've been talking about. We've got a lot of research that we publish on our website, 80,000hours.org. We also have a job board that you can go and check out, which lists around 200 or 300 job opportunities or vacancies that are open at the moment that we think would allow the right person to potentially have a really big impact. And we also offer like one-on-one coaching and headhunting for specific roles, which people can potentially apply for online.
And why the name 80,000 hours?
Right. Yeah. So we were originally called High Impact Careers, but people misunderstood that as some kind of professional consulting headhunting thing, which was exactly what we were not. So we changed it to 80,000 hours. And 80,000 hours is roughly the number of hours that you would work in a full-time career. So I think it's 40 years times by 40 hours a week for 50 weeks a year gets you to 80,000 hours over the course of your career. Kind of there's two angles on that. One is that 80,000 hours is a hell of a lot of time for a single person. So it means that if you could improve kind of the effectiveness of what you were working on by just 1%, then maybe it would be worth spending 800 hours to do that. So it suggests that there's a lot of value in thinking ahead about how you're going to use that huge resource and how you're going to use it well. Hmm. On the other hand, you could point out that 80,000 hours relative to the scale of the massive problems in the world is kind of just a drop in the ocean. So you're not going to be able to solve everything. You're going to have to choose pretty judiciously, like what problem you think you want to tackle and how you think you can make the biggest contribution to solving that problem.
Hmm. That's interesting to me that high impact careers didn't do very well. I mean, is it just because it was attracting more people in the corporate world than it was your target of the recent graduate demographics?
It was a name that sounded good at the time, because in our head, when we think high impact, we mean high social impact. We mean doing a lot of good. But I think if you're at kind of a career fair and you have high impact careers, it sounds like you're hiring for an investment bank or something like that. That was kind of what it draws to mind.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, among the general population. Yeah.
What do investment bankers tell themselves that makes them believe that they're high impact?
Oh. I think it's maybe just the vibe of high impact is kind of this like masculine, slightly aggressive vibe to it. It's like, oh, you're going to like, you know, have an amazing, exciting career. I don't know. I mean, I guess branding is difficult, and that's kind of what it drew to people's minds.
Impact just meaning money.
Yeah, maybe.
It's funny. I thought that people would still think of it as doing good, but I'm always really careful to tell myself too much that I'm having an impact or that I'm doing good, because I see that as a potential barrier to thinking about the things that I'm doing. Or like if I feel too good about it, then that can be a source of distortion or confusion, or it's like a social desirability bias thing.
You mean that you can feel yourself being drawn to things because there's a certain romance associated with them, perhaps, and it's like it's not quite justified?
Or if you think that you are having an impact, that if you get too caught up in that identity, because I've been in this world. I worked in a green company for a while, and this was a thing that I saw, unfortunately, a lot of the time, is I didn't feel like the people that were around me were asking questions about whether the thing that they were doing was actually helping, but they were spending a lot of time and energy patting themselves on the back, believing that they were doing something great.
Yeah.
And it rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah. I mean, that is one of the things we point out to people is just because something kind of claims that it's having a social impact, or just because it kind of, that's its branding or that's its sense, doesn't mean that it necessarily is having a huge social impact. I mean, we kind of think that, you know, working at some nonprofits might be 100 or 1,000 times more effective than working at others. In part, just because it seems like there's a lot of nonprofits that deliver interventions, that deliver services that don't really benefit people.
Hmm.
So that's kind of something you have to look out for. You don't want to just like, you don't want to just have a career that kind of looks on the surface level like it's having an impact. You really want to like dive down and double check that it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I guess I was surprised that people weren't attracted to the high impact careers thing, because I thought that they would have that sort of thought. But 80,000 hours, it's a little more humble in a way, because you're just saying that you're putting in the time and you're trying. You're not necessarily making the conclusion that you are, in fact, being effective. However, the effective altruism that can potentially have that element of assuming that what you're doing is working.
Yes, it's presumptuous to some extent. The effective altruism is okay. Where it really gets bad is if calling yourself an effective altruist, because then you're really being presumptuous that you're being effective, and perhaps you're implying that other people aren't, which isn't ideal. So I think I usually say, you know, people involved in the effective altruism community, rather than effective altruists, because I don't want to assume that we're having an impact. That's perhaps for others to judge.
Yeah, it might. If you believe that you're an effective altruist, then maybe you won't be an effective altruist because you are allowing that to cloud your judgment in some way. Well, I mean, and altruism in itself is sort of a loaded concept in itself. Some might believe that altruism doesn't actually exist because it suggests some sort of self-sacrifice. Or I guess, how did Dawkins think about it? It was like, if this survival machine, which holds these genes, is willing to sacrifice itself as a survival machine for the genes, for the sake of the genes, that was how he defined altruism, if I recall correctly. But I think a lot of people think of it as like, they're sacrificing something and feeling good about it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't care less whether the things that people are doing involve any sacrifice. Ideally, that'd involve absolutely no sacrifice. That would be much better, because then they'd be more motivated to do it, and they don't have to suffer any harm. So I guess maybe we should call it effective helping, because all that matters is kind of the help that people receive, not whether people have like paid any cost in order to do it. But effective helping, maybe it doesn't sound quite as catchy to me.
I think it's good. I think it's provocative. It's just fun to dissect it, I guess.
Yeah. There is this habit, I think, that people can fall into where they measure how much good they're doing by like how stressed out they are, or how much they've given up, how much money they've given away, like what sacrifices they've made. And I think that could be a big mistake, because it's possible to, you know, burn yourself out, give away a lot of money, and accomplish absolutely nothing really for recipients. You don't really measure accomplishments by how much you've sacrificed. I think the reason is that if people are judging your personality, they're judging how kind of praiseworthy you are in a sense, or how virtuous you are, then they might look at, you know, how much are they willing to burn themselves out to try to help other people. But in terms of actually, I think how morally good what you're doing is, that's burning yourself out is just a downside. It's just a cost. What you really should focus on is how much the beneficiaries are gaining from what you're doing.
Right. So what are some of the other ways that people have mental errors in assessing whether the thing that they're doing is having an impact?
Yeah, interesting. I think there's potentially quite a few we can go through here. I guess one is just going with your gut to great an extent. So if you were going to make a big purchase, or like you're going to go buy a car or a house or something like that, most people would go out and do quite a bit of research. They might, you know, get consumer reports, go and like find out which car is the best value for money. You know, how safe are they? How reliable are they? That kind of thing. And that's a very, very sensible thing to do. Even given that, in fact, like most cars you can buy on the market are kind of pretty good, because if they were that bad, then other people probably wouldn't have bought them and they wouldn't be available. But I think when it comes to doing good, I think people can kind of be more inclined to just like follow their gut or follow their heart, follow their instincts. they don't, when people give to charity, it's relatively rare for them to do the same level of investigation or research as they would do when they were buying a car or a house. They don't go, you know, what exactly does this organization do? Like, is there evidence that it's having an impact for beneficiaries? How much does it cost, you know, each person that they're serving? Those are the kind of questions that it would be natural to ask, I think, if people were really being analytical and sensible about it. But that's a relatively rare thing for people to go out and do. And people also, there's a lot of kind of cliches or tropes, I guess, about having an impact. Education. A lot of people like focus on education, and like education is the root cause of like a lot of problems, and that's the way to make a difference. I hear that from many people. But how many people who say that, you know, have kind of like really looked into the research on that? How many of them have looked at, you know, does funding education or providing more education like really lift people out of poverty like more effectively than doing other things that you might do to help them, like even just giving them cash or, you know, giving them health programs? People, yeah, there's a certain willingness to make like sweeping judgments or generalizations based on like not a whole lot of evidence or not a whole lot of analysis that people have done, which I think is kind of an interesting phenomenon. And actually, I think for most, in most cases, funding education probably is a bit down the list of the most effective things that you can do.
Well, and we've spoken to Brian Kaplan on the show before, who wrote The Case Against Education, which is a provocative and interesting book with an interesting argument. But I think this also touches on what we were talking about earlier with our perception of people who live in a place that's, say, impoverished. We might think, well, we should build a school because, you know, learning happens in schools and that is education, and therefore people get more jobs. When in fact, what might be happening is that, you know, the child has terrible diarrhea or, you know, has like intestinal worms and can't go to school, whether the school is outside or inside, and that the giving them the worm pills might be more effective. Or one charity that I ran some numbers on this, I was surprised, but it's the I Denies the World Foundation. For like $99, you can iodinize like 1,000 people. And that may improve their IQ by as much as 7 points. I may be misremembering parts of this, but I did look at it pretty closely.
Yeah.
It was just one of those other like very counterintuitive things, because below a certain level, you have completely different concerns.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. I'm not an expert on global health and development, so I shouldn't speak out of turn. It's like not the area that I specialized in, but I do know a few things about that. And one is, as you say, that for lots of people who are in dire poverty, it just seems a lot easier to deliver kind of health interventions that improve their capacity to absorb education and to fulfill their potential. Things like making sure that they don't have like nutrient deficiencies or aren't going hungry all the time. Than it is to deliver education, at least with a fixed amount of money. Back in December, I had Rachel Glenister, who is the chief economist at the Department for International Development in the UK. And so she'd been looking at a bunch of the evidence on what education interventions work in the developing world, you know, countries like Kenya or India, looking at kind of the randomized controlled trials that have been done, where, you know, they deliver an intervention to some schools and not to others, and then see if it improves student outcomes. And she said kind of the classic things that people think of when they're imagining improving education in the developing world is, you know, having more textbooks or having more teachers or having more physical resources. But by and large, it seems like these things have very little impact on educational outcomes, at least given kind of potentially the bad incentives that teachers face, or like just how bad, if the school is run really badly, then it's...
Oh, give me an example of bad incentive.
Oh, well, in a lot of countries, teachers are not really... they can get paid even if they don't show up, honestly. There's a lot of like teacher absenteeism. In many of these countries, it's not a great paid profession either. But yeah, no, it's very common for kind of public servants, teachers, just to not be showing up to class a lot of the time. So that's one thing that people focus on, is just trying to get teachers to come to class at all. So teachers and books cost a lot of money, but it seems like in many cases they're just having no impact on student outcomes. But something that seemed like it had a really huge impact was just streaming, like putting students into classes based on how much they know on their ability, on the kind of their scores in tests, rather than just based on their age. Because basically something that's going on when you actually do get teachers into the classrooms to teach is that you just have in these schools in India, like massive range of like how much the kids are keeping up. Like some of them, you know, are reading at a very advanced level, and some of them are, you know, barely able to read at all. And of course, that means that the students that can barely read at all are just getting totally left behind. And there's a bit of a tendency to just follow a very strict curriculum down to the letter based on what you're teaching at that time, even if, you know, half of the class is totally disengaged because they can't follow it. Now, this is extremely cost effective in a sense, because just dividing kids up into education level rather than age costs basically nothing. It's like not really any more expensive, but they found that the effect on student learning was massive, massive. And that's the kind of thing, if you actually, in some areas, the ones that we might talk about later, it's very hard to get kind of concrete evidence on, you know, exactly what's working and how much you're having an impact. But in some other areas like global health and development, it's possible to run experiments. It's possible to collect good data. And people have done that to a substantial degree. And you can just have a lot more impact by actually kind of consulting that evidence and not just going with your gut, kind of thinking things through, looking at costs and weighing up benefits.
So yeah, instead of going with your gut, actually doing a bit of research, you have plenty of that on 80,000hours.org, right?
Yeah, .org.
And it's interesting what will capture people's imaginations. Like, for example, there was this issue with like plastic straws lately. And you know, just as one example of something, I don't know actually the details of that, because I didn't look into it, because I sort of rolled my eyes and said, okay, here we go again. Here's something that people are getting bent out of shape of with, when there's probably a lot more effective ways to use people's time and attention. Do you have any insight into why stuff like that happens?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert on environmental policy, but I did look into this a little bit because I was curious about it. And the plastic straw thing seems like a really big misfire. It seems like a distraction to me. It's kind of a little bit crazy.
Do you understand the story better than I do? Because I just saw it just like as a headline or something.
So it's possible I'll get things wrong here. I think I only have a cursory knowledge. But I think that the plastic straws might have been specifically of interest to people because there was a famous video of, I think, a straw being pulled out of a turtle that had been injured by the plastic in the ocean. So it's like a very emotionally grabbing kind of image. And concept. And so people started zeroing in on straws specifically, because that was the rubbish that was affecting this specific animal. But if you kind of just look at the bigger picture and think about kind of all of the waste that we're producing, straws are just like a tiny negligible fraction of all of the plastic waste, even of the specific items. And in terms of like, you know, the environmental damage done by manufacturing them, it's like negligible because they're incredibly light. They're just like not a significant fraction of the environmental damage that we do as, you know, Americans or Brits. And actually another thing that I found that fascinated me when I started looking into this is that if you live in the United States or, you know, Australia or the UK, these kind of developed countries have very good waste collection processes. So just the vast majority of waste that's produced gets collected in some form and ends up in landfill or getting recycled. And so, you know, how is it that there's so much waste in the oceans then? Basically, it's coming from kind of riverine areas and countries that don't have very good waste collection, where there's not really a culture of like throwing things in the bin. Or even if you do that, there's a high risk that it won't be collected and taken away to landfill. So just a huge amount of rubbish gets thrown into these rivers and goes out to sea. There's a bit of that in like China, although I think that's getting a lot better. Vietnam, Indonesia, India.
Was it something with Starbucks or something where, okay, we need to stop using plastic straws in these places, because were people's conclusion that, oh, then they end up in waterways and then they end up in the noses of turtles? And so therefore we should stop using plastic straws? Was that?
Yeah, I think there was a campaign about ocean waste, which then for some reason ended up really fixating on straws specifically a great deal. And so some places started to ban straws and companies are trying to get out ahead by getting rid of straws. You know, I guess, you know, I'm not a big straw user. For most people, they don't use straws. Although there's been like some pushback on this from people who have disabilities who are pointing out, you know, actually, I really need straws because otherwise I can't drink because I have like issues swallowing or picking things up. So it's not the case that for everyone, straws are a negligible issue. But I think just the main thing is when I approach an issue like this with ocean waste, my initial intuition is to look at all of the waste in the world and then like try to figure out like where, or like look at all of the waste in the ocean and figure out like where did it come from? Where did like most of this come from? And if you're taking that approach, so where did most of it come from and like what might be done to stop the really big classes of this? And there you'd be like, well, it's because rubbish isn't being collected in big cities on rivers in India or Indonesia. That's where like most of this is coming from, things like that. And given that, you would never kind of zero in on plastic straws in developed countries, like a tiny subset of all waste in the US, in a country that doesn't actually cause that much rubbish to go out to sea anyway.
So the majority of the rubbish in, or the your UK-ness is rubbing off on me. Or
actually,
sorry, you're Australian.
Yeah, yeah. Although I live in London. Now,
you live in London. The amount of garbage in the ocean, you're saying that the majority of it is from poor waste collection in a place like Indonesia or India, and actually a small fraction of it is coming from the Starbucks in Manhattan,
yeah,
or the many Starbucks in Manhattan.
Right.
Manhattan.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that the data on this is amazing, but I think it was a paper in Nature that we can stick up a link to in the show notes that I think strongly suggested this. I mean, if you think about it, if you get a Starbucks in Manhattan and then you make sure that it goes in the bin, the odds of it ending up out at sea is just extremely, extremely low. It's like it's going to get recycled or it's going to go into landfill. So kind of you don't need to feel terribly bad about that. It's true. I'm sure that some terrible people do throw it into the water. But kind of we could focus on that, the littering aspect, rather than kind of getting rid of straws entirely. Even if like what we wanted to do is focus on countries that are responsible for a relatively small fraction of the problem. I mean, I guess, yeah. So I would look at like, where is most of this ocean plastic coming from? And then if you're thinking, if it turns out that this is correct, that it's, places that have poor rubbish collection, where people are throwing waste into water too often, then maybe if you really care about this, we should send off a couple of people to become experts in waste management and then like go and try to improve the systems of waste collection in these countries. And it could be that, you know, just having 10 people do that is worth a million people trying to like reduce their use of straws individually.
But it's difficult to get support for that because of the way that the human mind works, right? We see this image and then it becomes this meme that gets recycled over and over again till there's people like myself who know there's something going on with straws but aren't even quite sure what it is and are pretty sure that it's ridiculous. And then we end up talking about it on this podcast and then some other people are like, these guys are terrible. They're terrible people. They want plastic straws to end up in the noses of sea turtles. When in fact, if you comb through things, you're likely to find that whatever actions being taken, whatever attitude people have about this thing is probably way far off base. And it's often driven by that gut feeling.
Yeah. I mean, in some parts of our life, kind of we follow our intuitions. We follow our instincts. And if you're thinking about like, you know, judging someone who's in front of you, like, are they a nice person or are they not a nice person? Then, you know, humans are kind of evolved to have fairly good instincts for that. Not perfect, but they can like kind of tell if someone probably has good intentions or bad intentions, like much better than chance. But the modern world is just so impossibly complicated. It's like you're part of these like massive systems, like almost we understand almost none of it unless we like go and investigate it. There's just no reason to think that kind of our involved instincts or like, the things that we've learned, the kind of instincts that we've developed from that, are going to be really informative about like what actions we can take that are going to improve the world in the biggest way. It's just in the same way that kind of people don't think that they have instincts about like which chemicals are going to cure diseases. They know that this requires, you know, expert researchers to go out and try to figure that out. And then you kind of, you go with what your doctor says more than what your heart says. I think likewise, trying to figure out how do we make the world a better place involves expertise and research and analysis. I think to be honest, when you point this out, most people are with you, but it like, it has to be drawn, like people have to like force themselves. They have to bring it to their attention that, yeah, I really need to think this through.
Yeah. Well, it's often counterintuitive. I guess we're so often interacting with things where there is a butterfly effect that, you know, so many different levels down the chain is going to cause some other thing to happen. I mean, it's kind of gets to the point where your typical person wants to just say, hey, like, this is too complicated. I can't think about this or even be skeptical of the experts who claim to be able to tell you whether this is this thing or that other thing is effective. I mean, is there anything that you can say to people like that to convince them that that effective altruism ways of thinking are truly effective?
So can you just ask that question again? Maybe could we just go for the start.
Is there a way that you would be able to convince somebody who was skeptical of experts being able to say whether something is effective or not and illustrate that, yes, it is in fact more effective than your gut feeling? I don't know whether this is too general of a question or not, but I can just very easily imagine. Even in my own mind, I can feel this idea of feeling so overwhelmed that you feel like there's just nothing you can do. And you know, the way the mind works, you have an emotion and then you find some way of rationalizing it. So the way you might rationalize it would be like, well, these experts, these people who claim to be experts on the impact of plastic straws or waste management, well, you know, they don't actually know. It's too complicated. There's so much of a butterfly effect going on. They can't possibly know. So I'm just going to just live my life and, you know, enjoy it.
Yeah, maybe I have two things to say to that. Actually, maybe three. So the first one would be the world is extremely unpredictable and chaotic. And kind of I have more of a focus on areas that are like much harder to understand than just like waste disposal. That's something where you can get like really good data. And I think I have a pretty good sense of what things are working and what things aren't. But it gets worse and more complicated than that. But that's also kind of true of your gut. Like if it's true that experts can't unravel all these chaotic implications, even after, you know, spending their entire career trying to figure out what actions are helpful. And it seems unlikely that kind of your gut instincts are going to do that as well. So that challenge like slightly cancels out. A second thing is that, we encourage people to try to find like what specific things can they do, say with their career, with their life, that have the biggest impact. And typically, I think just doing a few things that are really important, really well, is a lot more effective than spreading your efforts across like lots of different areas and trying to make like tiny differences there. And so, to some extent, I think if you can like nail the issue of like I've chosen to work on a really important problem and I'm using my career to try to fix it, and to some extent, you can like relax about the other stuff that's going on. You can like focus on somewhere where you are in a position to make a really big contribution, and then you don't have to stress about every other issue. It's like the same way that like a surgeon doesn't also have to know, doesn't have to do engineering. It's like each of us to some extent can specialize in areas where we can figure out what works, and then let other people handle other issues.
So by being confident that you have already allocated a huge portion of your life's resources to something that you've deemed will be effective, then you can maybe find a little bit of peace when it comes to these other things where you worry that you might not be making the right choice.
Yeah, I think that's right. Focus on the big picture. Focus on the important decisions. Have you heard the 80-20 rule?
Yes.
Yeah. So like 80% of the benefit comes from kind of 20% of the work. I think it's the case that when you're trying to have a social impact, like 80 or 90% of the impact comes from a handful of decisions that you really want to get right. And then kind of the other 80% of questions, maybe you can like just let them slide. Don't stress too much. You don't have to be perfect in every respect.
So if somebody is looking for that most important decision that they can make to have that larger impact where they can stop worrying so much about all the different minutiae, what might they do?
Yeah. So I think one of the most important decisions that people make, which they often don't spend very much time on, is trying to figure out what social problem they're actually going to be aiming to solve, in their career or with their donations or with their volunteering. And I suspect that, you know, if you choose like among the most pressing problems in the world, then you can potentially, you know, have 100 times more impact than if you kind of stumble into working on something without doing any analysis at all. And in fact, there's like ways that people, I think, systematically choose to work on problems where it's not so impactful. So for example, a lot of people kind of stumble into working on a social problem because other people around them are working on it. And so it comes to their attention very easily, or because it's kind of trendy or fashionable to worry about an issue and to get on board with that. But in life in general, you get declining returns to putting more effort into kind of solving a problem or kind of anything you do, that the more you do it, typically the returns decline. So it's kind of the first $10,000 that you spend on a car kind of gets you most of the way there. And then spending another $10,000, the car only gets a little bit better. And then another $10,000, the returns start leveling off pretty seriously. And I think that's how it is with solving problems in the world. The first kind of 1,000 people that you have focusing on it does a lot more good than the second 1,000 or the third 1,000.
So it's like marginal benefit.
Yeah.
Right?
So this is declining marginal returns to more effort.
Oh, okay.
And we think that there's like mathematical theoretical modeling reasons to expect kind of logarithmic returns to putting more effort into solving a problem. So that is to say that kind of each doubling of the resources that you put in accomplishes about the same amount. And we observe this somewhat with like scientific research. It seems like each doubling of scientific effort accomplishes about the same increase in progress. But of course, you know, going from 1,000 people to 2,000 people is a lot smaller than going from 2,000 people to 4,000 people or from 4,000 people to 8,000 people. But each of those increments has probably been similarly valuable. So yeah, one of the important criteria that we look for when we think about problems where people can have an especially large impact as one extra person working on that problem is neglectedness. We want to find things that are really important, but that like almost no one's paying attention to, because those are the places where you're going to find really low hanging fruit, like really, really big impact things that you can do that other people haven't already done or haven't already tried. So we're always looking for, low hanging fruit that's still being left there.
So for example, what might be issues that we kind of don't need any more people working on this problem. We have enough. Any additional people added onto this are going to not have the impact that they could just by nature of the fact that so many people are already thinking about this.
Yeah. So what's a possible example? I guess I'm very interested in US politics and UK politics, like, you know, mainstream issues about like whether the leaders we have are sensible people who are nice. And I think that absolutely is an important issue, but it's also one where kind of millions, tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of people are already paying attention. And if there was like something really easy that a typical person could do there, then probably it's already happened. There's kind of a lot of energy already going into that. So it's not the kind of place where you'd expect to find some transformative thing that just a typical person can do that's going to make a massive impact.
So for example, people talk about global warming a lot. Do we need more people? Or climate change.
Yeah.
Do we need more people working on climate change, or is an additional person working on climate change just not going to be worth it?
Yeah. So on climate change, I think the scientific consensus seems completely right. It's very concerning. I think it's going to be a big problem for humanity going forward. And so that would seem to suggest that it'd be great to have a lot more people working on it. And indeed, I think working on climate change is a lot better than working on a lot of other things. I love it whenever I see like more effective government programs to tackle climate change. But I think, you know, if I was advising one person on like where they could get the biggest bang out of their career or the biggest bang out of their money, it probably wouldn't be climate change, because there already are like hundreds of billions of people potentially are worried about this. Millions of people have kind of already allocated their career to trying to tackle this problem. And by no means have they succeeded. And it's true that like, having an extra person will help to solve it. But it's not the kind of place, again, where you'd expect to find like amazing opportunities that just no one has yet looked at. Because when there's already millions of people working on it, like having one extra person probably just doesn't make as big of a contribution as kind of finding a new area that's really important, that might be of similar importance to climate change potentially, but there's only 10 or 100 people who are working on it. That's where like one incremental person potentially, you know, can get bigger bang out of their career.
Can you think of any examples of areas that might be like that are neglected that no people wouldn't normally think of?
Yeah. So I think one that's kind of medium neglected, but more neglected than climate change, I think, is pandemic preparedness. So, you know, in the past, like one of humanity's biggest enemies, biggest threats has been new diseases that spread around and kill a significant fraction of the population. I think the last big one was the Spanish flu after World War One, which killed tens of millions of people. It was a couple of percent of the world's population at the time.
Well, the Black Death was 1300s, right? They wiped out half of Europe. We haven't had something like that for a very long time.
I mean, we've also got like smallpox. Smallpox, when you know, colonists arrived in America or Australia, killed like I think debilitated like 80% of the population or something like that, or the cocktail of diseases that they brought.
I mean, who could know? Right?
Yeah. So I think there's like some reasons to think that this risk is getting higher than in the past, or that there's some reasons to think that it's getting lower. So one reason to worry more is that like international transport is so fast, and there's so many people flying between countries now, that if a new disease arises, it can spread to all across the world, including countries that don't have very good health systems, within a matter of days. And then it becomes extremely hard to control.
Right. Well, and it's easy to think about this as like, well, this hasn't happened for a long time, and so therefore people don't think about it, right? It's like the turkey being fed every single day and thinking that humans are good, and then Thanksgiving comes and, you know, it's changed.
Things change
all of a sudden. It's like this black swan event occurs, and it's so catastrophic that it makes investing it worthwhile.
Yeah. So in general, I'm very interested in kind of risk management and global risk management issues. And I think there's like systematic reasons why there's amazing opportunities there. And one is just that it's so hard to kind of, well, people, there's so many things going on in people's lives. Like, who has time to categorize and worry, like, appropriately about all of kind of the global threats that, that humanity faces? For most people, it's just like too difficult to even think about it. And so in order to like figure out what things to worry about, people use this heuristic called the availability heuristic or availability bias. So they look at what things have happened recently, and then they kind of protect against those things. And then anything that hasn't happened for a while, they kind of forget about it. Mm-hmm. And you notice this in government as well. So for example, in terms of like biological threats, the US government has been extremely focused on anthrax because there was a bunch of anthrax attacks. So that was the thing that people thought of when they were worried about biological attacks. But I think if you actually do the analysis, there's other things that are much more concerning that just haven't happened yet. And so I think if you're looking for problems that are like threats that are very severe that are neglected, looking for things that like could like there's it seems like there's a high probability that they could happen in future, but they haven't happened yet or haven't happened lately, or they're a new threat that has arisen that hasn't had the chance to happen yet, but probably the risk is going way up. That's where you can find some really juicy opportunities, I think, to do good.
Well, I would imagine, though, that if you were to find one of those areas, you might never find out whether you were actually being effective because it never happened.
Yes. If you succeed, then nothing will happen. Nothing will go wrong. So I guess some people involved in the effective altruism community, they try to have an impact by going into areas where you can get really strong evidence about what's working and what's not. So things like global health and development, where you can get a reasonable sense of how much it costs to save a life and things like that. At least the immediate effects seem more predictable. Then there's kind of another group, of which I consider myself a part, which tries to have an impact by going and exploring areas that like approaches and areas that seem really high leverage, where maybe people aren't going into it because they're so speculative that people who want to like be able to quantify the impact that they're having tend not to go into it, and so they're very neglected. But we think like someone who's uses careful analysis, like really thinks it through and becomes an expert within that field, can anticipate what things might go wrong, and they can try to build an internal model of the world that will allow them to have some confidence about the expected impact that they're going to have. So this involves being willing to accept a high risk that you may ultimately actually not make a difference, because it might just be that you spend your life kind of preparing to avert a threat that just because of chance, it wouldn't have happened anyway. But in general, I advise people to focus on maximizing their expected impact, which is kind of like, if things go well, then how much impact would you have times by the probability that happens. So, and I think if you're willing to be one of the minority of people who are willing to do very chancy things, to go out and like pioneer new areas where you can't really quantify how much impact you're going to have, then I expect that gives you more leverage over the future and how it goes relative to trying to kind of play it safe and do things where it's very easy to quantify.
So if there's a thing that there's a 0.1% chance that it might happen, but it would be the extinction of all of humanity, then one might, through that calculus, decide that it's worth concentrating on that problem. Is that kind of how that works?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, problems have like different scales, and then if the scale of the problem or the scale of the badness of it is large enough, then that might compensate for like a lower probability of fixing it. So kind of a nuclear war would be so bad that even if you had only a 1 in a million chance of preventing a nuclear war, that would still be really valuable. Like a lot of people would consider that worth doing. And that's kind of how I think about a lot of my work. It's like the odds of having an impact are potentially quite low, but if we succeed, by golly, it will be a really huge impact. And so I regard that as valuable. The mathematical term is in expectation.
Is this related to the idea of, I think it's called Pascal's wager, that I think it's an argument for believing in God, that if there is a God and you will be punished for not believing in God, there it would be really bad because you would go to hell. And so therefore, you should believe in God. Is that related, or am I tangling things?
Well, it's slightly different from the Pascal's wager case, because the Pascal's wager case usually involves infinities. So it'll say there's like infinite value if you're right and infinite disvalue if you're wrong. Mm. So that is a reason to kind of believe in God. Because I think here we're just dealing with like very like finite amounts. And they're also like, it's not as if there's like a 1 in a billion chance of these things being true. I think like the odds of nuclear war is really within our lifetimes is really quite material. You know, it's maybe like 1 to 10%. These aren't tiny chances, and like much crazier things happen all the time. So
it's not the same as saying I believe that there's a 0.1% chance that the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is going to come and destroy the world. And so now I'm going to dedicate my life to preventing the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man from coming and destroying the world.
You don't have to believe in crazy fantasies to imagine nuclear war. We've come so close to having nuclear wars already in history. There's like lots of near misses. You don't have to be crazy to think that there could be a war between China and the US in the 21st century. If you look at kind of the reference class, so like a bunch of similar cases in history, where you've got kind of one power to some extent ceding control to a new rising power, then more than half of the time they go to war. Now, it's a slightly different situation here because we have nuclear weapons, which discourages them from fighting. But yeah, I think that the risk of like some serious conflict between the US and China in the 21st century, you'd have to be, I think, very optimistic to say it's less than 10%. So these are like real threats. I guess if we're being purely philosophical, yeah, you could imagine there's like something like even worse and there's a 1 in a million chance. And so you should go and work on that. But I don't think that these things really bite because I think that the probabilities are just really material. The probabilities of a group of people who are talented and ambitious and like really want to focus on preventing this stuff, probability of them as kind of a community having an impact on these things, I think is also just really material. So we're not talking about negligible. We're not talking about infinitesimals here.
But in the case of, say, nuclear war, certainly that's something that people can imagine happening and it would be really awful. Is that neglected?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question that we had to analyze when we were thinking about nuclear war. I think short answer is not terribly. I think for most people trying to work on nuclear issues probably isn't a great option. Another one is just like most people don't have a very good personal fit for that, because if you want to do that, then you're probably going to have to go into either the military or kind of the national security community in some form. And most people just kind of aren't cut out for that. That's not a good fit for their personalities or what they want to do with their lives or what they've studied. And it is true that, I mean, I think this was neglected and a very promising area to work on in the 40s and 50s. There were people who foresaw what was going to happen with nuclear weapons, but even before they were invented or even before like most people believed that they could be created. And tried to like invent or like figure out like what was going to be the international scenario, like what was going to be the international relations implications of this, and how could we design a system such that nuclear war would be extremely unlikely even once we had nuclear weapons. And to some extent, they had a bit of success there. So if you were alive in the 50s and you were kind of someone who was very good at this kind of analysis, then it would be a great opportunity. But now like so much work has been done and so many institutions have been set up that in 2019, it doesn't look so amazing. Unless, of course, you can find some really neglected sub-area. So like possibly there's not a lot of people who do kind of public campaigning on nuclear issues, maybe because it's just a bit hard to kind of get the public that excited about nuclear war, or like that excited about nuclear stuff in general. But if you kind of any area, even if it's like not neglected in general, it's possible to find sometimes some sub-areas, like amazing opportunities that people haven't spotted yet, where that like that approach is neglected. But I think for most people, finding that with nuclear war is going to be tricky.
Yeah. So pandemics, we want to avoid a global pandemic. We want to avoid nuclear war. What are some of the other, I mean, especially the neglected ones, the neglected realistic areas that a person couldn't have an impact?
Yeah. So I guess another thing that could really shape the future of humanity in a big way that was neglected, at least until recently, and to some extent is still neglected, is kind of transformative artificial intelligence. So it does just seem like artificial intelligence could end up subbing in for like most of the work that people do. We're not sure when that's going to happen, or even like entirely whether it's possible. But if we do design, you know, machine learning systems that are capable of doing most of the generalized reasoning that the humans are capable of, it seems that could really revolutionize society and would have massive implications, like economically and in terms of international relations, in terms of everything. And so making sure, firstly, that those algorithms are safe to use and are not going to backfire in some way that we haven't foreseen, and that they are, that we know how to program into them, that they are going to like do things that we actually want rather than things that we don't intend. As we already see with some machine learning algorithms that are deployed, and then it turns out that they're achieving goals that are quite different than the ones that we thought that we were telling them to do. That seems like a really important work. And also figuring out how, like I was saying, nuclear weapons, 40s and 50s, this is a thing that like dramatically changed the nature of war and international relations. It's possible that artificial intelligence could have similar impacts in the longer term. There's a lot of people who are kind of concerned about this in the national security community and in international relations.
Well, how might that play out?
So both the US and China see artificial intelligence as a technology with like very important strategic implications. So I guess one way that you could imagine this being important is that you could use artificial intelligence to try to disable the other side's nuclear weapons. Seems like there's a risk of that. That's something that people have been analyzing and seems material, and probably we need to adapt to that, because then that like creates a strategic unbalance where one side could potentially attack first and expect to benefit from that. In general, another one is you can program AI into fighter jets, and it seems like you can make them a lot more effective, such that you could like gain air superiority. Kind of any new technology that creates the possibility of new weapons can destabilize what's kind of the peace that we have now, where both sides believe that like attacking would be disastrous for them and for the other side, so they don't do it. It also seems potentially machine learning systems that can learn to hack extremely effectively are probably on the way. And they could be used kind of for cyber warfare. I'm not an expert in this area, but it does seem like one side advancing far ahead of the other in machine learning or in artificial intelligence, having access to like much greater intelligence, much greater analytical capability, could really freak out the other side destabilize international relations in some way. So that at least seems to have, it's worth having some people look into that. I'm mentioning this not because it's like necessarily, it's like definitely going to be a problem, or is like necessarily the biggest threat that we face, but rather because it seems like it's kind of an emerging issue that's very important, that until recently, very few people had been investigating. But now there is kind of appearing this community that looks at, artificial intelligence and thinks about the political implications, the policy implications, the strategic implications, figuring out how we can adapt to a world where artificial intelligence becomes a really big deal in a way that's kind of safe for everyone and leads to good outcomes.
Right. So in addition to the way that artificial intelligence might affect global conflicts, the artificial intelligence itself may be a danger, or the implementation of it in society.
I mean, potentially. I guess, so for example, some people will be familiar with this issue that YouTube designed kind of algorithms that were meant to optimize for engagement and watching time, which ended up kind of unintentionally in pushing people down spirals into like crazy conspiracy theories. So they'd look at, something that was like verging a little bit on a conspiracy theory, and then the next recommended thing would be like an even crazier conspiracy theory video. And this basically like caused some people to become like absolute conspiracy theorists, because just all they were getting fed was this material suggesting that like the government was out to get them, like everybody's lying to you. And this was like, this was not an intended outcome of this algorithm. That is just the result that it had, given kind of the instructions that we gave it, not realizing how it would optimize for the thing that we'd asked it to do, which was improve watching time. And I think that's kind of writ small, a problem that you get. Like if you're deploying, well, there's going to be a lot of, as we design machine learning algorithms that can do more general reasoning and make better decisions than people can across like a wide range of domains, there's going to be a lot of competitive pressure to roll them out. Because if other businesses are using machine learning algorithms to kind of figure out how they can have a competitive advantage, then being the one company that doesn't do that puts you at a competitive disadvantage. And likewise with kind of countries, there's some competitive pressure there to do that. So there's going to be like some degree of kind of a race to implement these things. And we want to make sure that in the process of delegating effectively a lot of decision-making power within society to machine learning processes, if indeed we kind of find a way to get machine learning systems that can do general reasoning, in the process of doing that, we don't end up like deploying them before we've actually figured out how do we get them to do what we really want, what we ultimately want, rather than just like optimize for some kind of superficial things that kind of initially correlated with the outcomes that we desired, but in fact like lead them to do stuff that isn't what we want.
I think the famous example is, what if it decided that it needed to turn the world into paperclips because we've given it some goal that then causes it to decide that it needs paperclips, and therefore it turns all the matter of the earth into paperclips.
Yeah. So this would be the most like wildly extreme kind of case of this value misalignment, where I guess hypothetically you give, some artificial intelligence system that is just unfathomably more powerful than us and more unfathomably powerful than anything else in the world, a simple instruction like make the maximum number of paperclips, then plausibly it will figure out that the way to do that is to kind of get rid of the people who might turn it off. And then it just has a free hand to turn the entire world and the entire universe into paperclips. I mean, it's not going to play out like that. I think that's just kind of a sketch of like a sense in which things can go wrong. If you have a system that's just like way more powerful and like way more able to accomplish its goals than what you bargained for. You see this all the time with machine learning systems now, that you give them an instruction and then they find some way of doing the thing. It's like a genie. They find a way of doing something that is like very different than what you intended. So often, if you get a machine learning system to try to play a computer game really well, it finds some kind of cheat or some kind of bug in the game that allows it to like rack up the score in a way that was not intended. There's various cases of this. And I guess you might worry that this could have, like, if we're going to put, you know, artificial intelligence in charge of military equipment, which is probably going to happen, and it's kind of already gradually happening now, we really want to make sure that we've like programmed it correctly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess this brings us to the idea of long-termism is that some of the things, decisions that we might make today would have an impact on theoretical people who might exist in the future. And can you explain a little bit why long-termism is, I think it's one of the driving values of 80,000 hours and the recommendations you make, correct?
Yeah, it's one of our key ideas. So let's just take a step back for a second. So if you're looking for problems that are really neglected, then one way to do that is to kind of find beneficiaries, groups that are suffering or groups that could be advantaged that are not as obvious to people as kind of people they might meet in their own country on the street or people who might appear on television. So one way you might do that is to, like, rather than focusing on helping people who are in your city or in your country who, like, may already be getting, like, a bunch of support from the government, go and focus on, like, the world's poorest people in the world's poorest countries and the world's poorest places. People who like are so poor and like in such remote locations that it's like you're unlikely to even become aware of their circumstances in the normal course of events because they're going to be more neglected by other people and there might be higher impact opportunities to help them. And indeed, it does seem like there's people in Kenya whose incomes are probably a hundredth of most of the incomes of people listening. And so if you were to give money to them rather than spend it on yourself, potentially they... it, as much as you think people get logarithmic returns to higher consumption, which is like a reasonable estimate, they could benefit, 100 times more than you could. This is even adjusting for like different costs of living in these countries. So there's one thing. Focus on people overseas, people who might get neglected. Then you might think, well, what other beneficiaries are there out there who could benefit from my actions that they might be getting neglected by people because they're just not so salient or because of perhaps moral errors that people are making? And another one that people stumbled on fairly early was like, what about the welfare of animals? Only a few percent of charitable donations in the United States go towards the environment and animal welfare. And most of that is spent on things that I think are not terribly effective, like kind of pet shelters and welfare for pets and stray dogs and things like that.
Well, hold on a second. Yeah. You're going to have to expand on that at some point. Yeah. Whether you do now or later is fine.
Okay. Well, yeah. So the reason I wouldn't focus on that is like, one, there's a bunch more money going there. But also just like the vast majority of animals that humans are interacting with and causing benefit and harm to are animals in the farming system. There's like billions of chickens that are slaughtered in the United States every year for human consumption, hundreds of millions of pigs. And like 99% of these animals are in like factory farms where if you just go and like look at the videos, if you just like look at the equipment that's being sold to these farms, it's, I think, a moral abomination what we're doing probably because there's every reason to think that these animals, can feel pleasure and pain. And they're being kept in just horrible conditions for basically their entire lives, their brief lives. And then they're being killed often in quite unpleasant ways. So if you kind of just do the math on that and you're like, well, here's how many animals there are. And like, here's how bad their lives are. Kind of like, here's maybe an estimate of like how much an animal suffers relative to a person. Unless you place like an extremely low probability on animals being conscious, which seems unreasonable, or place an extremely low weight on the suffering that they endure, which also seems morally unreasonable to me, then it seems like maybe you can have a much bigger impact by kind of persuading or like doing things like, corporate welfare campaigns, which have been amazingly successful in the United States at getting companies to improve the conditions of farm animals, especially caged chickens that, don't even have enough space in the cages to turn around.
So you're saying relative to the stray dog that's on the street, that using a certain unit of resource would be better allocated toward helping the factory farmed animals that are suffering than, say, the dog that's a stray animal?
Yeah. So if you just kind of do a ratio of like the number of animals and the amount that they're suffering as against how much attention are they getting or how many resources are going towards helping them, the ratio is like just totally way off such that like it seems you can get a lot more bang for buck by focusing on farm animals because there's so many more of them and they're so much more neglected. And the reason is obvious that people's heartstrings are tugged by kind of stray dogs that they see or kind of pets that they know are suffering. It's easier to raise money for that than it is to raise money for factory farmed animals, which are very deliberately kept out of people's sight so that they can stomach the idea of eating meat in these countries. There's kind of another class of beings that you might be able to have a larger impact by focusing on them because other people are failing to do so and we're treating them very, very badly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then What other groups could we find that might be neglected by society as it currently stands? Groups that we could benefit a lot, or who we're currently doing bad things to, in a sense, but because they're just not top of the mind for us. And I think the other big group is kind of future generations. So most people don't just care about themselves or even just their children. They also care about like whether they're going to leave a good world for their grandchildren and their grandchildren's children. And if you just think about like how long humanity could continue to exist on Earth, just using even current technology that we have, or, you know, technology that we're going to invent soon, we could have another million generations before the Earth becomes uninhabitable. But at the very least, we might hope to live for, you know, another million years, which would involve, you know, another 10,000 generations, because, you know, humanity, roughly our species has been around for a million years so far. In which case, it just seems like there's going to be far more people in the future than are alive today, far more beings that we could help who exist at this other time than happen to exist at the present moment that we're in. So if you place some moral weight on the effects of our actions on future generations, which I absolutely think that we should, rather than just privileging the time that we happen to be alive, then here's this enormous potential group that we could have large effects on, maybe. So then what things could we do today that might benefit this group? People have been trying to analyze this. You know, there's like researchers who think about this topic. It's kind of their profession, is trying to think, what things could we do that would make the future better for future generations? And one of them we've been talking about a bunch, which is like worrying about catastrophic threats to civilization, to the world, from which we might never recover. Such that, you know, if we have a nuclear war today, if there's a war between the US and China, this could just like destabilize civilization, take it off track, such that it leaves a worse world for people, not only, you know, in a decade's time or in 100 years' time, but in 1,000 years' time. And it could even get to the point where we cause ourselves to go extinct. And that would be bad, not only because kind of we and everyone we love would die, which would be terrible, and I think there's a real risk of that happening. But because we would snuff out the possibility of all of these future generations, you know, all of the future people whose we could have built a wonderful world for and who could have had great lives, they'll never get to exist. So that's an extra reason, that I'm focused on kind of threat reduction and global risk management, is that, not only do I think that there's a large impact by reducing, threats that could damage the world now for people who are alive now, but it also has this bonus that you could potentially make the world better for the thousands of future generations who might be to come.
Hmm. What sort of objections do you get most often to the idea of long-termism, of doing things to benefit people who don't exist?
Hmm. I think there's probably two broad classes. One is people who think that we should place less moral weight on the welfare of future generations than the present generation. I guess some people go as far as to say we should place no weight on the welfare of future generations, which seems far too extreme to me. We could kind of explore the philosophy there a little bit. Maybe the other one is just skepticism that we can have effects that will be very long lasting, or at least that we can predict whether those effects will be good or bad. So I was doing another interview a few weeks ago where I said, oh, it'd be good for the future if we avoided a nuclear war today. And they were like, no, really? who can say there's this issue in philosophy, which actually a lot of people involved in the effective action community are kind of on the bleeding edge of research into, which is moral cluelessness. So if you think that the majority of beings who we affect or who suffer the consequences of our actions are beings that will be alive in the future, people who will be alive in the future, then because it's so hard to foresee what effect, you know, each of the things that I do might have on those people, and that stuff is really important. But it also seems like, you know, if I could figure out, and maybe I could figure out what effects it would have, that would be really important. I'm to some extent kind of clueless in my day-to-day life about the moral, the morality of my actions. And so I think that is a difficult challenge, though, although one that can be to a significant extent answered by just pragmatism and trying to do our best to understand what effects our actions will have, and trying to find guideposts or like things that we can change about the present that seem on balance fairly likely to lead, like more likely to lead to a better future than a worse one.
So wait, the idea of moral cluelessness isn't so much that it's not some sort of argument against long-termism. It's just an observation that we tend to be morally clueless about the way that our current actions affect future generations?
Yeah, I guess it's like a slight paradox. So like, I think in as much as you just do think that future generations matter to some extent, there could be like vastly more people in the future than are alive today, and that our actions have big impacts on them, then even if you think it's like very hard to predict what those actions are, then nonetheless, that would be like among the most important things you could do. The fact that it's hard to do doesn't really change that that would be like a very important thing to look into. You can't kind of escape that. Because anything else that you try to do to improve the world today, anything that you try to do that's safer, just pushes the question forward to like, well, what impact did that have on future generations? So I think it's not so much a rebuttal as like a difficult practical question of like, how do we avoid being completely clueless about the effects on our actions on the long term?
Well, can we dissect a little bit of some of the philosophy around it? I could say, for example, everybody is destroyed, everybody dies, which would be a really terrible day. But then these future generations that didn't end up existing because of it, well, they never existed to suffer the consequences of their not existing. Is it just that their not existing is the consequence?
Well, let me blow your mind for a second. It seems like almost like most of the actions that we take, or many trivial actions that we take, basically change the identities of like everyone who will exist in the future. So in a sense, they're like swapping out all of the people who would have existed, like swapping in a different bunch of people. And I'll explain how that is. So let's say that you like stop in traffic for a bit in a big city, kind of hold up traffic for 10 seconds, or even just like throw a ball onto the street such that like cars are moving around at different times. Then gradually this kind of ripples out to like the whole city and eventually the whole world in terms of like everyone's going about their day like a few seconds, like sooner or later. And then whenever basically who is produced at the point of conception, or who is produced when two people like create a child, is dependent on what sperm happens to conceive that egg. And if it happens a second later or a second after, it basically the probability is that it's going to be a different sperm. And so you'll create a different child because, you know, half of the genes are going to be completely different. And so like any action that you take that like gradually changes people's like timing, or like even just the movements of their bodies by like tiny amounts over the course of like one or two generations, results in like a totally different mix of people existing on the planet. And we're all doing this all the time. This is an issue in population ethics called it leads to the non-identity problem.
Well, couldn't you then, sorry to interrupt that, but couldn't you then, I mean, it seems like every single action you took all day long would then be causing people to not exist.
Yeah. I mean, so my view is that what we want to do is, my ideal would be to have a world that has a lot of people in the future living wonderful lives, like flourishing lives where they're really happy. And having a world where there's like people having great lives is better than a world that's barren and empty and has nothing in it.
But isn't that a human bias?
In what way?
I mean, yeah, we think that because we're humans and we like being alive. I mean, we like being alive enough to make ourselves not alive. So wouldn't we naturally be biased in that view that a world with people living and enjoying life is better than a world where some thing that we tried to prevent but that we were unable to prevent, yeah, you know, caused everybody to be wiped out?
I mean, I also apply this to kind of animals and like, you know, descendants of humans that might appear. So it's more a thing about like positive states of consciousness are a good thing to have. Now, I should say, to be clear, like most of the things that I do don't really rest on this premise, because I think the risk of extinction and catastrophe within the current generation for people who are alive now is sufficiently high that you get a really big bang for buck just trying to prevent these things, even if you don't care about future generations whatsoever. But I think if you like me think that it's bad to like do things that will cause the next generation to have bad lives or to simply not exist, which I think is actually like very intuitive. If like a politician was running for office and they're like, yeah, sure, the decisions I make will like ensure that there are no future generations, that humanity ends right now. But who cares? They won't be there, or they'll never exist. So like vote one for me, like pro extinction candidate. I think that most people would not be like, yeah, that sounds fine. Like to begin with, like we gain a lot of meaning in our lives from the fact that we know that our children are going to like benefit from the things that we're doing, from like what we're building up, from the research that we do, from our creative works. We want to be part of a broader story of like civilization and humanity making the world good and accomplishing great things. There's this thought experiment where you imagine, what if you knew that like a day after your own death, the world would simply cease to exist? That would be like the end of it, and like no one else would be around anymore. And I think most people, they're not like, well, I wasn't there, so it doesn't matter. And it's not even that it's like it's bad for the other people. It's that it like strips the meaning away from your own life, because everything that you're doing, like having children, like trying to make a better world, trying to contribute to like the human story, is like stripped away, because as soon as you go, then all of that disappears as well. Anyway, so I'm slightly avoiding like the more technical philosophical issues here within population ethics, because they're a little bit hard to like go through on a podcast. If you're interested in this, we can put up a link to kind of a great summary paper of this issue in ethics, which is called Population Ethics. And we also have a great podcast with the philosopher at Oxford, Hilary Graves, where we discuss, what views are plausible on this question of like, do future generations matter or not?
Yeah.
And I agree there's a certain counterintuitiveness to the idea that like future generations are kind of overwhelming importance. And maybe you want to think, what matters is just like people alive today, like specific people who we can identify. But if you try to like specify that view clearly, you find that it has like absolutely wacky implications, like implications that are even bizarrer than the idea that future generations matter a great deal. So for example, if you think that what really matters is like only specific identifiable people who are like the same and comparable in like two different scenarios, then this problem that like every action that you take changes the identities of future generations means this is called the non-identity problem. It means that basically you don't care, even if you like, if you take some action that like will make the future world like a terrible dystopian hell, then you won't even care, because in the process you would have like changed exactly who's conceived. And so there'll be a different bunch of people who are living terrible lives rather than good lives. But you will have done nothing wrong, because there'll be like no specific people who you can compare between the good world and the bad world. Mm. Which I think is even more odd conclusion than the one where you just say, well, it's good to have people and animals living good lives, and like bad to have them living bad lives. And it's like, I guess somewhere in between that, to have there be nothing at all. Mm. Some people might've heard of Derek Parfit and his book Reasons and Persons, which like goes into this in great methodical detail.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this long-termism as I've prepared for our interview. I'm certainly not yet on board with it. I don't know whether it's just because it's just one more extremely difficult thing to think about. But it did make me wonder, though, and I wonder if you've thought about this, how the effect of the incredible amounts of very rich video and audio media, and of high quality, high fidelity video and audio media that we are accruing, whereas it's like, you know, when I was 11 in 1990, and I was watching something that was 50 years old. Well, it was from 1940s, and the quality of the audio is terrible. The quality of the video is terrible. I feel very separate from those people. But if I'm watching something now and it's 50 years old, it's from like 1970. Mm. And if I've got a good reproduction, like you can listen to, I don't even know if Jimi Hendrix was still alive in 1970. I don't think I'm not sure. But you know, you can listen to somebody who's been dead for a very long time or see them in a movie, and it is like they are right there singing to you, or you are seeing their face up close, and you feel this connection with this person who's been gone for so long. Mm. And it seems like the more crisp that fidelity is, like if I listen to an old Delta blues artist from the 30s, or listen to Charlie Patton or Robert Johnson or something, and it sounds all scratchy, it sort of has this distance to it where it's, you don't feel as connected. It's more of an escape in that way.
Yeah.
Remember watching the Ken Burns documentary of World War II, and there's some very high quality video in there of these young men who are going to war, and you look at them and their faces are like, that could be your friends that you just hung out with last night. It's so crisp. And it really brings an immediacy and impact to this event that occurred in the world that I think makes you think about it in a deeper way than if you didn't have that level of fidelity. And so I wonder how that would affect the way that we think about the long term.
Yeah, it's interesting. The effect of colorizing old photos in terms of making it feel real is really quite remarkable. I've noticed exactly the same thing. And there is, I guess, maybe it's one reason why I think people don't, but like we're not allocating, you know, 10% of GDP to trying to make the long-term future or like to benefit future generations, that is a little bit harder to get excited about them because they don't exist yet, because they're not tangible. We don't know, like, we don't know what specific people are going to benefit and exactly what impact all this is going to have. So people have tried to get around this. The philosopher Nick Bostrom wrote this brief letter from Utopia where he had someone basically like writing from the future saying like, we managed to like stay on the right path and build a world that was peaceful, and we like invented all these amazing new technologies that make life wonderful. And here's what's going on in the future. Like, please don't mess it up. Like, please make sure that in fact we do exist and this happens, to try to make it more tangible. Like, just how good we could make the world if we keep inventing science and technology, if we keep advancing in our moral values, and just keep incrementally every generation making the world a better place. Yeah, we could make the world fantastic, and I think that's a vision that people should maybe be a little bit more excited by, and trying to paint that story rather than just having horrible dystopian science fiction might help to get people more motivated to do things today that would make that happen.
That makes me think of another thing, which I don't know how on topic it is, but it's fun to talk about these theoretical things with you because you're somebody who thinks about this more than most people that I talk to. Do you think there should be a sports league in which all drugs and all any bionic modifications go? Like, you can do anything you want. You can take any drugs you want to play this sport.
Yeah.
I have my thoughts about I wonder how that hits you.
I have thought a little bit about the philosophy of this. I mean, yeah, let's take a step back. I think there is definitely something that's weird about how you can engage in like insane amounts of very expensive training, and have amazing equipment to play the sport, and like take time off from your job to just like do this all the time. And also, of course, some people are like born with much better physical capabilities to do, you know, something like swimming than some other people. And yet we draw the line at kind of taking drugs or like doing human augmentation. It seems kind of arbitrary. And I guess people say, well, the reason is that that doping or using sports enhancing drugs, that they're like bad for your health. But it's not obvious to me that they're like especially like worse for your like life or like all your health and like many other things that kind of sports people do, especially like just spending their entire lives doing this, like getting up at 6 a.m. every morning. That's actually sounds worse than just taking steroids, right? So I think philosophically, it's like a little bit harder to draw a distinction between like sports equipment and training and doping. So I don't know, maybe it would be very interesting to watch a league where there would just be no rules about what drugs you could take. And that would stimulate, you know, a renaissance in research into power or like physiologically enhancing drugs. But I also worry that would look awful that we would, you know, I'd suggest this and be excited about this. And then it would create some kind of like hellish vision of the future.
Well, I just thought about it because you were talking about this vision of the future, how if we made all these scientific advancements, things could be so much better. Well, if we had a sports league where any bionic modification was allowed, where any drug was allowed, I suppose a lot of people would think that it would set a bad example or something. It would certainly end a lot of certain debates about, can we have transgender athletes, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And it would just be anything goes. But one of the interesting side benefits would probably be, we know how big of a business sports is and how much money goes into sports medicine and performing better at sports. Well, wouldn't that just cause us to have all these wonderful technologies that would be especially useful for people who need them, people who need prosthetics or who need drugs to help with preventing muscle loss or improving cognitive performance if they have some sort of brain damage, et cetera. I mean, wouldn't it create actually a greater good for humanity if that happened? And is it an arms race? Is it an eventuality? Because aren't there some countries where, yes, in the United States, we might find it repugnant, but aren't there some countries where they're not going to feel that way about it? And it's an inevitability. Like, wouldn't this be a... Maybe I'm ignorant about China, but wouldn't this be like a something China would be into? And
oh, yeah, interesting. I mean, I think people have a lot of intuitions about kind of what's natural and what's not natural. And I think there's this instinctive thing to think that something is not natural, and so it's bad. And like this is kind of one of the examples of that, where I think people have this intuition against doping. Like, it's unfair, but it's kind of only really unfair because it's against the rules. There's no like really principled reason. and kind of any, yeah, changing your body, like having cosmetic surgery, doing lots of other things. People don't like it because it feels in some gut reaction as like being unnatural. But I think people should really question that, because almost everything that we do today was unnatural at some point in the past. And some people complained about it and said, no, this isn't a natural way for people to be. But then in the long term, we kind of benefit a lot from it. And it's true that like lots of, we might invent lots of technologies that happen to be unnatural and will lead to bad consequences. But I think we could invent lots of technologies that are unnatural that would have good consequences too. So for example, yeah, in some universities, it's banned to use, was it cognitively in enhancing drugs. So it, some people use things like,
As a student.
As a student. Yeah. Yeah. So I think,
how do you enforce that?
Well, I mean, it's not, in reality, people use them all the time. But it's like, it's just not clear what the principled reason for this is. Like, if we can come up with chemicals that make us more intelligent, that make us able to like learn more, do a better job, then why is that bad? People say it's unfair, but like, why is it any more unfair than studying more or like taking care of your health? And so you're like smarter because you know, went to the gym. I would love to see more research into, ways that we could make people have better judgment or be smarter that involve biology. But there's not a lot of enthusiasm for that. And there's this very odd thing that at least in the West, as you're saying, we're extremely focused on technologies that can solve problems. So if we can classify it as a disease, then it's acceptable to like take a drug to fix that. But if you're already quite healthy, however we define that, then like using any extra technology or any extra drug, or, you know, having surgery to try to make yourself better, that's not permissible. That's like viewed with as like somewhat disgusting, and unacceptable. And I just think that's like a lot more harder to justify on reflection than maybe what most people think.
Huh. Yeah. You have to earn it, I guess. It's like a Puritan value, perhaps. I don't know. I guess the reason that I don't take, you know, Adderall all day, every day or something would just be because I would imagine that it would cause an imbalance that would ultimately not get me where I actually wanted to go. I mean, it's sort of like the idea of you mentioned sports, just the possible negative implications of doing this thing your entire life. And this is one of these things that I guess it's a prejudice I have against the Olympics, and that I haven't frankly followed up on a lot. But just this idea of, okay, this little girl, when she was 4 years old, left her house and traveled across the country to then go do gymnastics for every day of her entire life.
Yeah.
And now this one moment where she might be sick or might break her ankle, et cetera, like everything that she's done in her entire life depends upon whether she can perform in this moment now or not. And if she does poorly, it's going to be terrible. Yeah. Like, that just seems like a recipe for disaster.
So you said earlier that athletes that doped, took performance enhancing drugs might set a bad example for other people. But I think that like people who spend their entire life just trying to swim like 1 second faster than someone else and like doing nothing more valuable for society than that, maybe they're setting a bad example, just to say something controversial.
Possibly. I mean, well, it depends upon, yeah, what are our values? What does it mean to be an effective person?
Yeah.
And maybe we're wrong. Like, maybe you can do that and actually be like a wonderful contributing member of society in some ways. I'm not sure.
I mean, it's interesting to try to classify, what are the benefits of having people be better at sport? So to some extent, maybe it becomes more enjoyable to watch as people like approach like very high levels of performance. But one has to wonder, like, do you ever like hit declining returns, that like having people spend like even more effort trying to go like even a little bit faster at swimming or running? Like, is the audience enjoying it that much more than if they were all just like 0.1 of a second slower?
And is it good for people to enjoy watching sports? It's sort of like the more that we get people to enjoy scrolling through Facebook, as we've seen, I would posit that we've reached a point of diminishing returns on our enjoyment of things. So like, just because people enjoy it
doesn't mean that it's,
does that make it good? And I've thought about that with, the idea of storytelling. I'm somebody who studies storytelling, and I think that being able to tell stories is a good way of influencing people and impacting them. But you look at something like Netflix, where there's just an endless supply of wonderful stories that you could sit and watch all day long.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder, is it a good thing?
I wish that that was the case. To be honest, I find it quite hard to find anything I want to watch on Netflix. I'm usually like out of programs that I want to see, but maybe I'm very demanding. I think that's right. We live at a time when you can like access all of the output of human, or like most of the output of human creativity at any point in time, like very easily and very cheaply, which means it's like, if you're someone who's easily distracted, it's a difficult time to really focus on getting things done and accomplishing your higher goals. But at the same time, like people have access to long form podcasts, like to like incredibly detailed, like to all of the papers they want to read, like incredibly long essays, to any book they want to get. They have access to like incredible wealth of knowledge and like really in depth, like things that can give them really in depth understanding of the world that previously people didn't have access to. So if you're someone who can really take advantage of that, if you're an infovore who is able to focus on what really matters, then it's never been a better time to be alive. Mm-hmm. But it is, I think all of us like feel the conflict inside ourselves between like scrolling on our Twitter feeds and getting distracted and like reading something that's truly valuable. It's not straightforward to stay focused.
Mm-hmm. Now that we've gone on that long diversion, thank you for humoring me. And actually, was there a thread that we left open there? And all that,
well,
that
I guess,
we wanted to, our loop we wanted to close.
We were talking about long-termism and the objections to it. I suppose you were saying the stories that we tell now might last into the future. So we can imagine someone in 500 years or 1,000 years, like listening to this conversation and thinking like, yeah, they're talking about me. They're talking about us, future generations, and how they had to make sure that we stayed on track and made the world a better place so that I could exist and have a good life.
Right.
I think, yeah, I guess it's an exciting prospect that people in the long term might look back on people who tried to make their lives better and be kind of excited by that.
It's an interest. It makes me wonder whether audio will still be a useful, considered a useful piece of medium. Is there instead something that interacts directly with your brain waves and causes you to have this is a virtual reality experience, like everybody's just in virtual reality all the time? Or is it pretty much kind of like things are now where we're just still walking around with headphones in and listening to other people talk?
Yeah, it's interesting.
I don't know. If you think of the way Nassim Taleb talks about technology, doesn't he kind of say like the longer something's been around, the longer it will be around?
Yes, I think that's called Laplace's principle, that you're likely to encounter something halfway through its existence. So like your best guess at how long something will continue to exist is equal to how long it's already been around. The Copernican principle, I think, and Laplace's law of succession. So I got a couple of thoughts on this. I'll go a little bit random. So if it is the case that human civilization continues to exist for thousands of millions of years, I think there's a good chance that like the beings that are alive at those times will be different than humans. They'll be like evolutionary successors, or possibly you could imagine they'll be running on computers in some form. It doesn't necessarily have to be the case that like for all time, we're going to have kind of the flesh and blood humans that are around today, that's going to be the kind of consciousness that exists.
They'll all be bionic athletes.
Yeah, something in that direction. I think that's a possibility. Or I guess you could have machine learning systems that end up becoming conscious and to some extent supplanting humans. Like the future could go in many different directions, and it's extremely hard to foresee. But I think for humans as we are, it's going to be hard to kind of tinker with our brains. Like the brain is a very complicated thing. It's like all interconnected. And then trying to tinker with it so that we can absorb information better than like seeing and hearing, I think might be quite challenging. Because like listening to audio like this, it's replicating the internal voice that you have in your head where you talk to yourself. And it's replicating the conversations that we have with other people, which is like things that we've very deeply, I think, evolved to have. And so, yeah, just finding a different mechanism for communicating with people into the brain, I'm maybe a little bit skeptical of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so then maybe people will be listening to it just on Apple Podcasts.
And, Apple Podcasts 2500.
And somehow my Libsyn account has lived on this long. So hello, people in the year 3000.
It's a glorious vision of the future.
So what are some careers that people normally think of as impactful as we get close to wrapping up here, that might not be as impactful as they assume?
Yeah, let's move away from the crazy stuff back to the common sense and slightly more practical.
Yeah.
Let's see. So I guess if you think about it, trying to have a big social impact, I guess people are very focused on working in nonprofits, perhaps. That's something that really jumps to people's minds. Or perhaps working in like corporate social responsibility roles or something like that. I think there are some very high impact nonprofits, but nonprofits also have some downsides. And as we were discussing earlier, I think very often they're kind of delivering services that aren't super useful or kind of working on the wrong problems. And for our like key target audience of like very talented people who are like 25 to 40 and very ambitious and really want to focus their whole careers on doing good, we tend to focus on things like, you know, becoming an academic or becoming kind of a senior public servant, going into civil service, trying to have influence over government, becoming like science and technology researchers, going into think tanks, maybe becoming a congressional staffer, becoming a public intellectual, running a podcast, perhaps, trying to improve society by spreading good ideas and good judgment. And all of these, I guess I'm just rattling off options, but maybe to give that a bit of structure. I guess we think you can, to some extent, break up careers that have a big impact into four different classes. One of them is earning to give, so trying to make a lot of money, and then giving that money to people or organizations that can make really good use of it to make the world a better place. So for that, you'd want to go into careers that pay really well, obviously. And sometimes we meet people who have like very good opportunities to make large amounts of money, but like not so many other good ways to make a difference. So that's a good option for them. Then if you want to get a lot of leverage over the world, then science and technology seems like producing ideas that then spread, that other people can copy and that can be used by millions or billions of people, is a way to get a huge amount of leverage and contributing to kind of knowledge that will stick around for a very long time and just like build on what humanity knows and is capable of doing. So that's kind of, yeah, science and tech and potentially becoming an academic, becoming a philosopher, that kind of thing. Then you've got like leverage over kind of resources in society, which you can potentially get by going into policy or politics. So if you just like look at the regulatory power of government, or like the power to do violence the government has, or the amount of money that it spends per like decision maker within government, it looks like each person on average, though it's very unpredictable exactly like who's going to have an effect on particular outcome, each person seems like they're getting a lot of leverage over like millions of dollars, potentially tens of millions of dollars that are getting allocated by the government. And like potentially, you know, much more in terms of like regulations that the government passes that have an effect on society. So that kind of offers a prima facie case for potentially thinking that going into government and trying to make it do more good with the resources that it has and avoid doing harmful things could be really valuable. Although people can probably think of some objections to that, which we could potentially discuss. And then another one is kind of general advocacy. So the kind of thing that I guess we hope to do through 80,000 hours is just spreading important ideas and knowledge to other people so that they can have kind of a larger impact. Trying to like change people's moral values in a positive direction. And there you can imagine like the reasoning to some extent behind 80,000 hours is that if I, through my work, can persuade just one other person to kind of make the career change that I otherwise would have made and to go and do like something as valuable as like what I would do if I weren't working at 80,000 hours, then that's as valuable as doing it myself. And so it seems like in as much as you have some really valuable knowledge that isn't widely known, which kind of we hope at 80,000 hours that we do, though I guess that's for people to judge, then sharing that knowledge and enabling other people to have more impact by like persuading slash informing them could potentially give you a lot of leverage over other resources. And we think that we've changed you know, over 1,000 people's careers, we've changed their path to some extent. And that's with like much less than 1,000 careers worth of input. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the other category is just direct work. So finding something, a project that you can do a really good job of that's working on a key bottleneck on a really pressing global problem, and then just killing it, building up an organization or like, yeah, doing the operations, running events, delivering a service. It's kind of everything else, but finding a really high impact thing to do at the at a more proximate level of impact.
Yeah, there's some counterintuitive things in there, and I remember reading "Doing Good Better," which was written by William McCaskill, who was he a co-founder of 80,000 Hours?
Yeah, he was. He's a trustee now.
That book really influenced me a lot as I was re-diverting my career a few years ago, and there were some surprising things in there, such as choosing to be a doctor doesn't necessarily save as many lives as one might think.
Yeah. So this is, it's been a little while since I've read this research, but this is one of the ones where we were able to get a slightly better estimate of the impact than we're usually able to do. So one thing is you can look at, we kind of mapped out countries by how good the health is, like how good the healthy life expectancy is. and looked at how many doctors they have per person in those countries. And kind of, there's a lot, as countries get richer, they tend to have more doctors, and they also tend to have better sanitation and like other things that improve people's health. But let's just say that all of the correlation between the number of doctors that live in a country and the amount of health in that country was completely down to medicine, which is absolutely not the case. It's like a much smaller fraction. Let's say that the doctors were causing all of that effect. Then you can see just very clearly that in some countries where there's very few doctors, where people are very poor, the impact of having an additional doctor is really very large. But once you're at the level of kind of medicine that the United States has, I think it has, from memory, I'm going to get this wrong probably, but it's something like 5 doctors per 1,000 people or five. Oh God, no, maybe I'm getting that wrong.
Actually, there's a lot of doctors.
There's a lot of doctors in the US, like a lot of physicians in general. It seems like on the margin, each extra doctor is having only a very small effect on people's health. Basically, this is just an example of kind of the declining marginal returns that I was talking about earlier, where it's like, if you only have a few doctors, then they're like giving out vaccinations, giving out antibiotics that treat diseases that are definitely cured by antibiotics. They're doing like this really important fundamental stuff that greatly improves health and that we have good reason to think works. Once you're like adding, you know, the 10 millionth doctor in the United States, you don't actually have that many, but like something like that. It's like, what do you then do with that incremental person? And it's kind of delivering the services that you otherwise couldn't deliver, which is the stuff that's like expensive, less likely to work. Maybe you're even like over-treating people. Maybe you're like delivering too much medicine. And just in general, I think doctors, everyone in health economics, everyone in medicine who like studies this thinks that people tend to overestimate the importance of medicine for people's health. What really matters is like, are you eating? Are you exercising? Do you smoke? Are you an alcoholic? That kind of thing. Once advanced medicine, it seems, is like only making a relatively limited contribution to people's health. I guess like standard sanitation is really important as well.
Wow.
Anyway, so from memory, I think a doctor over the course of their career would save a couple of lives equivalent, which is like great. It's like a lot more than some other people are doing if they're not doctors. But it also seems like if you're focused on saving lives, like the researchers at GiveWell who focus on kind of global health charities have found that they think you can save a child's life from malaria for a couple of $1,000.
Yeah, it's about $3,500 for Against Malaria Foundation, right? One life around $3,500.
Yeah. So I mean, these are estimates. It's like it could be higher, but it could be lower. And so if you think about it in terms of, well, if you donated $10,000 to the most effective charities, that might have a similar impact to like a doctor in a really rich country over the course of their career. It's like you can see that there's like, once you start analyzing things, the numbers can just seem really whack here. It's like, how can that possibly be the case?
Right.
And of course, so it also suggests that if you are trained as a doctor, as a physician, then, and you want to have a larger social impact, then, well, I mean, obviously you could earn to give. So you could like take some of your earnings and like give it to really high impact work. But you could also potentially go to a country that has far fewer physicians where each incremental doctor is able to deliver really valuable services that improve people's health in a big way.
Right.
So we can stick up a link to this series of blog posts. It's like, maybe we don't have time to get into like all of the like weaknesses of the analysis and like objections that one might make. But I think the broad story that probably a doctor has less impact on people's welfare and their health, at least in rich countries, than people think, is probably still right.
Right. I remember from the book, it was talking about somebody making a decision about what to do. And they were deciding, well, maybe I can go to a poor country and be a doctor there, but then my earnings are lower there.
Yeah.
And it became, the decision became, well, I'll be a doctor in the UK. I'll make all this money and I'll just give away anything above this amount. And that will save this many lives per year by donating to Against the Malaria Foundation. And the US government, they usually, I heard this somewhere that they consider a plan to be, or a program to be, effective if it saves a life for like, was it $7 million dollars or something?
Depends on the agency, but I think it's between like $3 and $10 million.
So $3,500 is very cheap to,
oh, yeah,
to save a life.
I mean, it's insanely cheap. I mean, so this is like one of the just most amazing facts about the world. It's, for most of human history, as listeners may know, it's like everyone was poor. 99% of people were like subsistence farmers. They were like living pretty close, like they were extremely poor by our modern standards. There was like 1% of people who had like slightly tolerable lives because they mooched off of the other 99% and like took a bunch of their money as like tax or whatever to live like sometimes lives of luxury. Basically, everyone around the world had pretty much the same income, which was like the amount of income that you need to survive to like not die. and a little bit more than that. But in the modern world, basically, some countries have used the Industrial Revolution and science and technology to just become insanely rich by the standards of history. It's like in the United States, people's incomes are like 100 times what they were in 1700. At least in terms of like material living standard. Obviously, like people's have welfare hasn't improved that quite that much, because after a while, you hear kind of declining returns from having a higher income. There's some parts of the world that have gone through this industrialization process, become like incredibly wealthy on average, or at least some people are incredibly wealthy. And there's other parts that are basically no richer than we were in 1700, because for whatever reason, they've gotten stuck for probably political reasons, war, like lack of good legal infrastructure, colonialism, that kind of thing. Which means that just from like doing fairly straightforward things, like taking money from someone who's like really rich in the rich world and giving it to someone who's really poor in the poor world, you can get like 100-fold increase in like the amount of welfare that's being generated by that income. I think that's just an amazing fact about the world. And it's like maybe not so obvious until you actually like sit down and look at the numbers and think about it. And yes, this is adjusted for like purchasing power in the different countries. Yes, poor countries are a lot cheaper, but this is even taking account of the that fact.
Wow. And you know, when I got done reading that book, that was when I made, which is probably not very obvious to people, that that I made any sort of calculus in choosing to write books and about creativity and have a podcast. But when I looked at what I had, what limitations I had, my tolerance for risk, I decided that this was probably one of the more impactful things that I could do that I would also enjoy doing as well, that being a factor as well. So I think there's a lot of other people out there who are creators. That's why they listen to this podcast. They have their own audiences. They have their own podcasts. They have their own blogs. How would you encourage them to think about, quote unquote, I hate the word, thought leadership as a track, and how they can be effective in that?
Yeah, well, I mean, to some extent, I'm in that track of being a podcast host. And as I was saying earlier, you can potentially get just a huge amount of leverage by sharing with thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people, like really important ideas and information and moral values that otherwise they might lack. So if you're someone who can build up an audience and an audience that will like listen to you when you say important things rather than merely entertaining things, then that's potentially really valuable. To say something else potentially interesting about that, I guess you have to make sure. So there's only so much attention in the world. Like people only have so many things that they can look at, so many things they can listen to in a given day. So you have to make sure that you're not just like spreading the word about something. You're not just raising awareness about just anything. But it has to be better than what people would have been, what their awareness would have been directed to otherwise. And in addition to that, actually, if you have found a really important idea to promote, then you need to make sure that you're doing a good job of it, that you're not like turning people off of it by kind of like explaining it poorly or like lacking any charisma or charm, or offending people in the process of talking about it. Because if you do that, then you can kind of poison the well, because if people hear about it in future and they're like, oh no, this is that annoying person who like told me that, and they put it in this really objectionable, contrarian way. So, I like that. Now I don't like that idea. So you gotta be careful, like not to do harm. And if you're talking to lots of people, and especially if you have like a wide range of audiences and you're maybe not getting feedback on how people are receiving your ideas, then it's possible to leave things worse than when you started. I guess another is just for most people, like advocacy careers are just like not a great fit. Like personal fit is really important when you're choosing your career. For some people, it's obvious that they have to go and do something kind of technical and mathy because that's where all of their strengths are. And for them, the idea of going on a public speaking tour is just an absolute nightmare. And yeah, it's the ability to like hold people's attention, to like speak, like explain really complicated ideas in a way that that makes sense to people is really difficult. And you have to like pay attention to what your strengths are. So I don't recommend that if the idea of becoming an advocate sounds horrible to you, then probably you should feel free to ignore that. Another thing is just that there's like great opportunity. Like you have to compare it to your opportunity cost, and there's other great ways to have an impact other than advocacy, which I mentioned earlier. So I guess you could have someone who like has good opportunities to do advocacy, but might have even better opportunities in science and technology or going into government in a quieter role. So I guess if you're trying to maximize your impact, then you have to like weigh up potentially many good options, many options that give you leverage. But yeah, many listeners, if they're creators, they are going to want to go out and make the world a better place through their art potentially, or yeah, through speaking. I think try to like find ideas that you think are like really important and more important than what people would be hearing about otherwise. And find a way to kind of connect with people. Something is that effective altruism, as you might be able to tell, is kind of a very analytical thing. It's like we kind of lack artists actually, who are able to connect with people and potentially make ideas like, how do we ensure peace between the US and China? Or how do we make the long-term future go really well? To make that really connect with people on an emotional level. For which, like, you might need, you know, visual design, like music, like stories. We don't tend to tell stories very well. and so if you're someone who has that kind of ability, then I think you'd be extremely welcome and valuable in the effective altruism community to try to, yeah, fill these gaps where just existing, like, more mathy, economics-y people like me, tend to really fall down. When people ask me to tell a story, I'm just like, oh God, I can't do this.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I feel very cautious about this idea about being, careful to not do it poorly, you know?
Mm.
And I wonder about that, like, and I'm biased because I'm always like, if you want to start creating something, give yourself permission to suck, put it out there, let it be bad, and that's how you'll eventually get good. And certainly, I've been blogging for 15 years. You can go back and look at my first blog post. It's terrible. Now, I can't say for sure that I'm doing more good than I am doing harm, but it does make me wonder, like, if people are overly cautious about talking about things, does that cause, I mean, if there's too many people who are like that, and maybe there's a little bit of the Dunning-Kruger effect there too, where, like, the people who are cautious about speaking are often the ones who actually know something, you know? So I'm, like, so reluctant to agree with you on that one because I feel like, oh, people should be out there, you know,
exploring,
sharing what they think and, like, having a conversation and actually being more open-minded so that maybe I'm being idealistic. So they're being, they're open-minded enough to say, like, yeah, that annoying person, said it in this way that I didn't like, but okay, I'll give it another shot. I don't know. That's idealistic, but
yeah, it's really good. We got onto this because, last year we wrote an article, I think it was like, how to avoid doing harm in your career.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all of these thoughts and it was so tricky to message because, we don't want, like, everything kind of sucks at first. We sucked at first. Everyone has to, like, learn from experience before things become good and convincing and, like, and for the research quality to get high enough. And so when we were writing this article about how you can do harm in your career, and how that's a risk that people should be alert to, we didn't want to discourage them from, like, starting to work on really important problems and kind of getting off the ground and, yes, making mistakes, but learning from them. And there absolutely is this also selection effect that kind of the people who are most likely to read an article about how to do harm with your career and be like, oh God, maybe I'm going to cause harm with my career. They're the kind of cautious, thoughtful people who you really want to be going into something. It's the reckless people who won't read that article or be like, doesn't apply to me. They're the ones who you need to discourage, but the article can't achieve that goal. So we sat in it a while and, like, massaged the wording a bit to try to tackle this. I guess in terms of advocacy and creatives, I suppose you maybe want to, like, scale up gradually. So you absolutely have to start with something and it's probably going to be bad in some ways. And then you have to get feedback and improve it. But maybe what you want to avoid is doing things that are, like, extremely provocative or, like, are going to turn a lot of people off in a fairly predictable way that are, like, kind of designed to spread ideas by getting attention, by annoying people, by being obnoxious.
Which is very easy, which is very tempting to do because that's what gets you the page views and the retweets and all that stuff that you so much crave when you're creating things. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of a cheat code. If you just want to get attention, just say something super offensive to people and, yeah, you'll get lots of attention, but it's unclear whether it's helpful. Build your audience over time as you get feedback on how well things are going and kind of, aim for an audience that's proportional to, like, how much effort you've put into making the thing good and convincing. It's also the case that you don't have to convince everyone. Like, you know, I've said some things in here that, like, some people might find provocative and it's not going to be to their taste, but that's kind of unavoidable. I think being an authentic person and, like, expressing real views and, like, actually trying to communicate something substantive, you can, like, you can't make some people passionate about something without, like, turning some other people off. So you don't have to be cautious to that degree. I think people should aim to be more authentic and, like, say what they think maybe more than they currently do, but you also have to do it in kind of a thoughtful way, and I think not try to, like, not go out of your way to offend people just to get more attention.
And when you were talking earlier about there's only so much attention in the world and people can spend it in one place or they can spend it in another, I guess a switch really flipped for me that takes us back to the discussion we kind of started with, not the nicotine discussion, but the discussion about the length of the podcast, is that once you've got somebody to start listening to the podcast, the bias is going to be that they're going to want to continue or finish the podcast. And so therefore, you have now taken a larger portion of their day that they, and for many people, would use in some way that was less good for them. And so maybe it is better to have a long podcast and just maximize the amount of attention you're able to capture.
I mean, I don't want people to neglect their jobs and their families and their children just listening to the 80,000 Hours podcast forever. But I think it's so... We allocate some time to thinking about kind of unintended consequences or like the unseen effects of people's actions. And one of these is a really obvious unforeseen consequence of kind of doing anything is that people have 24 hours in a day. Anything you kind of encourage them to do, they have to stop doing something else. And so you have to think, like, is this actually better than the opportunity cost? It's not coming. Time is limited. Attention is limited. It's not coming for free. You have to be doing something better than the background level. And indeed, if you're like raising awareness about a problem that is real and serious and affects people, but is less important than what people would have been thinking about otherwise, is like, say people can't do anything about it. So you're like raising awareness about a problem that they can't help with. Or it's just like, it affects some people, but it's just like much smaller in scale and severity than some other thing that people might have had their attention drawn to, then you're like easily causing harm. And I think, for example, the thing with straws is like this. And so is plastic bags. So is turning out lights. I could just like go through all of these examples of memes that have attracted a huge amount of attention, dominated so much effort. And if you then actually try to quantify how much good has it done, just try to do the math. It's so small. It's so small. And so that's a sort of like advocacy that's potentially harmful. If you're like, I could try to like justify that if you're kind of skeptical on the plastic bag or lights, turning out lights thing. But
I'm definitely on board with you of opportunity cost loss, because I mean, actually kind of one of the secret motivations of the work that I do is that I believe so much in human creativity, and I believe in the power of somebody following their creativity and creating things. And it's not just because the things that they create are useful, but it's also because if they're doing that, they're not scrolling through Facebook, they're not having arguments on Twitter, they're not reading news that doesn't bring them any value. And at the same time, just the process of being creative, of doing that introspection that you have to do is going to cascade out into the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely on board with this idea of, what would you be doing otherwise?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. I'm a kind of social media power user a little bit. I promote my content on Twitter and on Facebook, and I like often just like share my thoughts on there and see what people have to say. But you really have to like set limits. So you have to like find ways to control how much you're using it. So I've never had the apps for Twitter and Facebook on my phone. On computer, I like use an extension in Chrome to make sure Firefox to absolutely block the Facebook newsfeed so that I never see it and get distracted by it. I feel a little bit like one of those drug dealers that like is selling something, but refuses to consume it.
Oh, I'm like that too. I mean, I block the Facebook feed, and I also have something that blocks recommended videos on YouTube, and recommended follows on Twitter. It's actually called Undistracted, and it's not a very popular extension. I've talked to the guy on Reddit. He just recently made it, and it actually has a lot of controls for a lot of different things you can block out. So something for people to look out for.
I think like me and other people have gotten more judicious about what kind of arguments they're willing to engage in. Although I suppose the people who aren't so judicious just spend all their days on Twitter fighting with people. I came up with this new rule of thumb recently, which is, you might have heard some rule of thumb about relationships, about how you have to say like 5 positive things for every critical thing you say to your partner. I feel like people should retweet like 5 things that spark joy in them for every thing that they retweet that makes them mad. And I think that would just like lead to a much happier world and like a happier Twitter community if people were like focusing on what's good rather than what's terrible.
I've experimented with this. I had a no complaints day where I said, I just went to the grocery store and there was food there, and I bought it, and then I ate it. It was
delicious.
Wonderful. I just pulled this lever on the sink and water came out, and I drank it and I didn't get sick, and it was amazing.
Yeah. Maybe we're getting a little bit trite here, but I so agree. I recently tweeted about the fact that I realized that I was kind of jealous of people who are like getting to go into first class on a plane. And they're like, oh, they get on and like they can have whatever food they want, and like someone will pour them a thing of champagne, and they got lots of space to like lean out. And I was like, actually, I realized I could do this every day in my house. I can lie down, I can sit on a couch, I can watch anything that I want on Netflix, I can order in any food to my house, I can have some champagne if I want. It's like every day in my house is better than being in first class on a plane. So, you know, I should be like really grateful for that.
And King Louis XIV couldn't have done any of that. So
yeah, it's so easy to take everything for granted. But yeah, I guess to slightly try to come full circle. Yeah, our lives are just so good that I think we potentially have a lot of slack resources. At least some of us do, that we can focus on trying to like help other people who don't have it nearly so good. Including, yeah, like animals that are suffering terribly, people in like very poor countries, and people in the future who are at risk of getting really screwed over by the short-sightedness and selfishness of the present generation.
That sounds like a great note to end on. I don't know if you have another final message to go along with that, but most importantly, where should people get more of you?
Yeah, so if you found this at all interesting, you should subscribe now to the 80,000 Hours podcast. I always feel bad when I have these conversations because like the issues that we're touching on, like nuclear war, war with China, different methods for having an impact, population ethics, how AI might affect the future. These are like incredibly complicated issues, which, you know, we can only just barely touch on. But we have like several hour-long interviews on every one of those topics. We've got like Daniel Ellsberg talking about risk of nuclear war, Hillary Graves talking about population ethics, Paul Cristiano, a very long conversation about, he's an AI researcher and kind of his vision of how AI might get deployed and how it could affect the future. So we've got, if you've enjoyed this, there's like a lot more depth that you can go into on the show. There's also 80,000hours.org. Maybe head there, possibly subscribe to our email newsletter if you want to get an update every 2 or 3 weeks on the new research that we've done. We've also got a kind of our key ideas page, which we recently put up. Kind of summarizes all of our core ideas and then links you off to different articles there that will allow you to learn more about those. I think that's, we've got profiles and different career paths. We've got like descriptions of kind of all of the different problems that we think are potentially really promising to work on. So yeah, check out the website, check out the podcast.
And if you've gotten this far in the podcast, you probably listened to long form. So 80,000 hours podcast perfect is for perfect you. For you.
For the 7 listeners who have stayed listening for this long.
Oh, no, I'm sure it's many more than that. Thank you so much, Rob. This has been great.
It's been fantastic, David. I love your work.
Is Love Your Work helping you find your unique creative voice? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation you need to become the creator and human you want to be? If so, please be a part of making this a special and nourishing and thoughtful show. Support the show on Patreon. You'll be an even bigger part of this show than you already are. If you contribute just a coffee a month, you'll be helping support the hosting and production of Love Your Work. Everyone has some unique creative gift to offer the world. Together, we can give people the tools they need to bring that work into the world. The world will be better off for it. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/cadavy. This is a different kind of model for supporting the work that you love. The choice is yours. Vote with your dollars, put your money where your mind is, and keep Love Your Work going. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/cadavy. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at patreon.com/cadavy. That's patreon.com/KA, D as in David, A, V as in Victor, Y. And if you can't support the show financially, and you've listened to at least 3 episodes, can you do me a favor? Write a review on Apple Podcasts. You can consider it your donation to help support the show. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsor Paula Spriggs, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pinkovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.